And it looks like we have everybody here. I'm going to switch to a different view so I can see the participants. There's here. All right. Good evening, everyone. This is the Tuesday, June 30th evening session of the Portland City Council. Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Here.
Udaly.
Here.
Fritz.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the Council are attending remotely by video and teleconference, and the City's made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The meeting is available to the public on the City's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and Channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to Council by emailing the Council Clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. Council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and promote social distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you all for your patience, flexibility, and understanding as we manage through this difficult situation to do the city's business. And with that, we'll hear from legal counsel on the rules of order and decorum.
Thank you, Mayor, and good evening. I'm having internet problems, so I'm going to race through this. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with Council Clerk's Office for Communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony and resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you will sign up for testimony while the City Council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you're a lobbyist. If you're representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify, unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct, such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected for the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware that all council meetings are recorded. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Carla, we have one item for this evening, item 511. Could you please read it?
Declare that along the COVID-19 pandemic that has created a health and economic crisis, a human-made climate emergency also threatens our city, our region, our state, our nation, humanity, and natural world, and that such emergency calls for an immediate mobilization effort, initiating greater action, resources, collaboration, and new approaches to restore a safe climate.
Thank you very much, Carla. Before we begin, I have a substitute resolution that I'd like to introduce. The substitute makes a few improvements to the language of the resolution that we all agreed on, including acknowledging previous climate action plans adopted by both the city and the county. And it also updates that the latest IPCC report tells us that we have fewer than 10 years to drastically reduce carbon emissions, as well as adding a specific timeline for the development of a climate test. Commissioner Udaly, after that, will also introduce an amendment on behalf of the council related to congestion pricing. Today, I've withdrawn my support for the I-5 Rose Corridor project along with my fellow city council members. ODOT has not met our goals around community and economic development or climate. And going forward, I will look forward to collaborating with Transportation Commissioner Udaly to prioritize congestion pricing strategies for our existing freeways and within Portland, ensuring that we're doing so in a way that's equitable and prioritizes low-income drivers to reduce traffic and help everyone get where they need to go reliably and sustainability. And before I complete my brief introductory remarks, I'd like to hear a motion to accept the substitute and second the substitute.
So moved.
Second.
Commissioner Hardesty moves the substitute. Commissioner Udaly seconds the substitute. Any further discussion on the substitute? Seeing none, Carla, please call the roll on the substitute.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Udaly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye. The substitute's on the table. Colleagues, in 2018, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned that we need to limit global climate warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels to avoid devastating and irreversible impacts on the environment and human civilization. We're already experiencing the impacts of climate change right here in Portland, including warmer winters, hotter summers, and heavier storms that have real consequences for the public health, for our economy, and for our planet. The science is crystal clear that we're facing a human-made climate emergency, and the time to act is now and with urgency. Today, we're now facing multiple crises. The climate emergency is the backdrop to a global pandemic, economic recession, and a national reckoning with police brutality and systematic anti-Black racism. All of these crises have several things in common. One is that they don't impact all of us equally. Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, people with low incomes, and our houseless community members are being disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 and the pandemic's economic consequences. These are the same people who are on the front lines of the climate emergency, experiencing the impacts of climate change first and worst. A second common thread is that addressing these crises requires collective action. We were able to flatten the curve on the pandemic in Oregon by moving swiftly and by acting together. Bending the curve on carbon emissions will also take collective action from governments, businesses, academia, nonprofits, and residents. We must all do more to address climate change as the emergency that is before us. Finally, overcoming these crises requires transformative, systematic change. We need to address the root causes of unequal impacts, which is systematic racism. This means that we must put equity and justice at the center of our responses and adopt new approaches to change the status quo. We're already taking significant action to address climate change, but we need to do more and we need to do things differently. The Climate Emergency Declaration outlines the new approach that the City of Portland will take to address climate action and an approach that's focused on climate justice and centers on the leadership and priorities of communities who are the most impacted. This includes youth, whose futures will be affected by the decisions we make today, and who've been leading calls for us to declare a climate emergency and take bold actions to address climate change. At this moment, we're envisioning a better future. We are re-envisioning what public safety looks like. We're envisioning how we can build a more equitable economy and invest in a low carbon future as we recover from COVID-19. And we're working to build a more resilient and thriving city in which all Portlanders have clean water, clean air, access to nature, and a safe climate. With this climate emergency declaration, we are committing to reducing our carbon emissions further and faster than we ever have before, to achieve net zero emissions before 2050. I know that today we'll hear calls for us to go even further and even faster than that. We know we need to act with urgency. And if we can do more, we must, and we absolutely will. The goals we're setting with the Climate Emergency Declaration are what international climate scientists are telling us are necessary and both aggressive as well as achievable. They require us all to push together in the same direction and to work together to ensure that our actions are benefiting those in our community who are most impacted first. It's worth noting, in conclusion, that this resolution is being put forward by all of the city commissioners together. This is us coming together and doing the work and committing to the future that we know we must all work on together. And with that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Udaly for opening remarks. Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Good evening, everyone. I'd like to echo Mayor Wheeler's remarks. Our climate crisis is an emergency, and it's undeniably linked to racial justice. BIPOC communities are on the front line of this crisis, suffering disproportionate harm, and it's well past time to take action. When discussions began about this resolution, I was concerned it would be an empty gesture if it wasn't coupled with strong policy solutions to some of our biggest climate challenges. And I'm really pleased to say that that is not the case. We've all given significant input, and I'm excited to share the resolution today and be here with all of you to take this step forward together. As Mayor Wheeler mentioned, today I withdrew my support for the I-5 Rose Quarter Improvement Project and resigned from the steering committee. This was my desire for quite some time, but I was committed to following the lead of community advocates, such as Albina Vision Trust, hoping against hope that we could still achieve some of the really valuable outcomes we were fighting for in this process. And today, when they announced their decision to withdraw their support, I knew it was time to vocalize my stand as well. It's vital to listen to communities of color and allow BIPOC voices to lead these conversations around restorative justice. So I want to thank Albina Vision Trust for their leadership and Mayor Wheeler for joining me in this action. If we care about the future of city and our climate, the choice is clear. Freeway expansions are not the path forward. I'm introducing an amendment today to replace the current congestion pricing clause with a stronger one. We know that congestion pricing is a demand management tool that works, but it only works if it's implemented in an equitable and just way that does not further burden the very communities we are attempting to benefit. And I'm committed to doing that work with the community. As Transportation Commissioner, safety, equity, and sustainability are my top priorities. And I want you to know that PBOT understands our responsibility to keep Portlanders safe, to root out inequities in transportation, and to cut carbon emissions rapidly. There is so much historic inequity in our transportation system, from gentrification that displaced communities of color and low-income Portlanders, to BIPOC Portlanders being subject to discrimination, harassment, and violence in our public right-of-way. And we must do better to prioritize the needs of Black Portlanders, Indigenous communities, people of color, low-income individuals, and Portlanders with disabilities. Our current transportation system does not work for everyone, and that is inherently unjust. We've already made some progress on this issue. The Rose Lane project, for example, was developed around a racial justice model. And our Pricing Options for Equitable Mobility Task Force is being led by Portlanders of color and will answer the question of how do we implement equitable congestion pricing and transportation demand solutions. But the resolution we're putting forward today is a significant step towards more comprehensive justice in transportation. The transportation justice lens will allow us to evaluate our actions based on whether they advance racial equity and reduce carbon emissions, which is something that PBOT already does, and it will shine a light on the intrinsic connections between transportation and climate, health, economic development, public safety, housing, anti-displacement work, and more. We cannot combat our climate crisis or systemic inequity without changing the way we live and the way we do business as a city. So I'm looking forward to hearing from all of our presenters today and community members. Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Thank you, Commissioner Udaly. Did you want to introduce an amendment?
Oh, yes. Sorry. Let me switch devices here. Here is the language. Be it resolved that since freeway expansions disproportionately harm communities of color and increase carbon emissions, the City of Portland will require demand management, including congestion pricing, implemented equitably and in close collaboration with BIPOC communities in any future freeway construction or expansion project.
And I will, Commissioner Hardesty will second that. Commissioner Daly, is it your preference that we leave this open during public testimony and come back and support it? Do you have a preference?
I'm neutral. I'm happy to hear what people have to say. I imagine it will be supported. Whatever makes sense.
I would love it if we did it after public testimony, because I do have some questions on what the wording means and how we can hold people accountable to those words.
Great.
All right. Thank you both, commissioners. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. You're the third mayor that I've had the honor of working with on climate disruption. And I recognize that we've come a long way since 2009, just as we've come a long way in understanding systemic racism and the injustices faced by many in our community. I have an amendment that would go after, be it further resolved, the Bureau of Transportation will work with TriMet, Metro, youth leaders, and community stakeholders to secure funding for free year-round transit access to all Portlanders aged 18 and under. And let me just stop and celebrate there with Commissioner Udaly that this is something that she and I've worked on for a long time, and it's really great that it's in the Metro measure that will go to the voters in November. So I'm celebrating that that will be a supportive role. I'd like to add, be it further resolved, per Comprehensive Plan Policy 9.26, transit funding, the Portland Bureau of Transportation will work with TriMet, Metro, and community stakeholders to consider funding strategies and partnership opportunities that improve access to and equity in transit service, such as raising metro-wide funding to improve service and decrease user fees / fares. And
second.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Very good. And Commissioner Fritz, would you like me to leave this one open as well for public discussion?
Yes, please. I will note that the language is taken directly from the comprehensive plan, and it is intended that we continue to work so that ability to pay fares is not a determining factor as to whether people ride transit. But yes, please leave it open.
Very good. We will so do. Any further amendments that anybody would like to put forward at this time? Seeing none. We have City Bureau directors, staff, and community leaders with us today to walk us through the declaration. And we are starting today with Director Durbin from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, Chris Warner from PBOT, Adina Long from the Parks Bureau, and Tom Reinhart, our Chief Administrative Officer. Take it away.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Commissioners. And thank you very much to the members of the public who have joined us for the special session this evening. I'm Andrea Durbin, the Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And Keelan, I think you're helping with the slide deck, is that right? Great. Yeah, you can go to the... you need to go to the first slide, please. There, that's good. The science is indisputable. Our climate is in crisis. We are already seeing the effects of climate change, but the truth is that climate change doesn't impact us all the same way. As we've heard in the opening remarks this evening, our frontline communities, including Portland's Black, Indigenous, and communities of color, are being hit first and worst by the impacts of the climate crisis, and Portland's youth will be facing the consequences of today's decision for the rest of their lives. Next slide, please. Before the global pandemic, we were already experiencing the climate crisis, and that crisis hasn't gone away. Although we'll expect to see a dip in carbon emissions associated with the stay-at-home restrictions, both here and around the world, as well as during the recession that follows, we also expect emissions to return to pre-COVID levels, if not higher, without significant interventions. COVID-19 is likely to change business, travel, and household activities into the future, and there's an opportunity for Portlanders to adopt lower carbon lifestyles that curb climate pollution. BPS will be doing more work on this area in the future. Experts agree global carbon emissions must peak this year in 2020. The actions that we take over the coming year, the next 3 years, and the next 10 years are critical to our future. We must make the right decisions now to bend the curve and protect our communities, reduce the climate harm for frontline communities, and increase the community benefits. As we begin to recover our economy and our community from the COVID-19 crisis, we need to ensure that we don't exacerbate the climate crisis and that we make decisions and investments that put us on a path for climate justice. That was one of the goals for the COVID-19 resiliency resolution that City Council adopted recently. Next slide, please. Over the next decade, Portland must cut our community-wide carbon emissions in half. This will require leadership. For comparison, over the last 30 years, Portland has been addressing climate change, and we've only managed to drop emissions by 19%, the green area shown in the chart. This is still a significant achievement when you consider our population grew during this time by 39%, and our economy grew by 36% more jobs, which you can see indicated by the blue lines on the chart. But those reductions aren't nearly enough, and we are not currently on track with our current plans. We need to more than triple our rate of carbon cuts. Together with Multnomah County, we recently released a progress report on the implementation of the 2015 Climate Action Plan, which is posted on BPS's website. That document contains a snapshot of the status of nearly 250 climate actions contained in the 2015 plan. It shows that we made progress in many areas and not enough in some. Next slide, please. We have 10 years to act with conviction and to make meaningful change. But the major message today is that we need to change the way that we are doing our climate work. We need to move away from these big multi-year planning processes that generate a laundry list of actions, some impactful, some less, and focus more on meaningful actions that deliver community benefits, significantly reduce emissions, and transition Portland to a clean energy community. And that work needs to start with frontline communities and center climate justice. We have a clear target of where we need to be in the next 10 years, and we need an iterative process that assesses and reports on our progress transparently, adjusts and accelerates actions where needed so that we are on track for meeting our goals, and enables Portlanders to hold us accountable. Hundreds of cities have passed their own climate emergency declaration, but today's action is more than declaring that the climate emergency is real. Portlanders already know that. We are making a commitment to all Portlanders that we are going to lead with bold action that drives carbon emissions down and increases community benefits, especially for those most impacted by the climate crisis, our Black, Indigenous, and people of color. The Climate Emergency Declaration maps out principles and priorities and a new approach that will guide our climate work over the coming decades, and it makes new commitments and sets new policy directions. Before we dive into reviewing the Climate Emergency Declaration, we've invited other bureau directors, including myself, Chris Warner from Transportation, Adina Long from Parks and Recreation, and Tom Reinhart from Office of Management and Finance, to give an overview of the climate action work actively underway across the city now and the work that we will be delivering on in the coming year. And I'll go ahead and start with the next slide, please. Even before the Climate Emergency Declaration, we've made shifts to center the priorities and follow the leadership of Portland's communities that are on the front lines of climate change. In the coming year, the city will deliver on a community-led, voter-approved priority by issuing the first round of grant funds from the Portland Clean Energy Community Benefits Fund, helping to make the vision of community-led clean energy projects and jobs that benefit low-income populations and communities of color a reality. We'll continue to support the capacity building of frontline communities to fully engage in building energy and climate policy development through the Zero Cities Initiative, which Council heard about earlier this year, with a specific focus on reducing the energy cost burdens experienced by many low-income renters. And we'll be developing an EV-ready code, starting with multifamily housing first, to expand access and options for communities of color and low-income residents to have access to electric vehicles and reduce the cost of owning and operating fossil fuel vehicles. Next slide, please. We're also advancing efforts on expanding community ownership of renewables and driving down emissions from commercial and multifamily residential buildings. For example, the city is working to become an anchor tenant in at least one large community solar project and reducing the time, cost, and complexity of solar and energy efficiency permitting processes. The PSEF fund will begin investing millions of dollars in clean energy projects in the building sector and bureaus are working to identify and remove permitting and code barriers that will slow those projects down. Policy efforts are underway in the coming year to decarbonize the building sector and following the lead of communities of color, and will emphasize improved comfort and utility savings for renters and protections for low-income tenants. And we're working to move away from a fossil fuel-based economy in Portland, both by addressing storage of fossil fuels in our community and strengthening the renewable fuel program that allows us to reduce air pollution and reduce community risks from the fossil fuels. And with that, I will pass to my colleague, Chris Warner from PBOT.
Thank you, appreciate it. Director Warner, you're still muted.
There we go. Thank you. For the record, Chris Warner, I'm director of the Portland Bureau of Transportation. Thanks for having us here tonight. This is an exciting night. We are advancing transportation justice, which means we ask ourselves a number of questions about each project and the policies and how they will reduce carbon emissions while advancing racial equity. Transportation accounts for about 40% of Portland's carbon emissions. That means to meet our carbon goals, we need to help Portlanders drive less and choose more low carbon modes of transportation whenever possible, including transit, biking, walking, carpooling, telecommuting, or electric vehicles. But the reality is that today, not everyone can make those choices because our transportation system is inequitable. Black Portlanders, indigenous communities, people of color, low-income individuals, and people with disabilities have less access to safe, convenient, affordable, and high-quality transportation options. And beyond access, we know that many do not feel welcome in our streets or safe from discrimination, harassment, and violence. We have serious work to do. By centering PBOT's work around transportation justice, that will require us to think holistically about our mobility system. There are no silver bullet solutions that we can accomplish our climate and equity goals. Instead, we're moving forward with a multifaceted strategy that includes allocating more space on our roads for transit, bicycles, and pedestrians through initiatives like the Rose Lane Project or our Safe Streets COVID response, so those modes become more reliable and comfortable. Making our streets safer, which involves reducing crash risks, but also means thinking beyond traffic safety and ensuring that hate has no place in our right of way. We will also work to expand mobility services and options that provide good alternatives to driving, including supporting community-led efforts to secure free youth pass transit for all and making it easier and more affordable to install EV charging infrastructure. Encouraging more sustainable behavior through programming and incentives like the transportation wallet. We're also looking at engaging the Pricing Options for Equitable Mobility Community Task Force to explore if and how new transportation pricing strategies can help improve congestion, reduce climate impacts, and improve equity across our system. And that's my contribution tonight.
Thanks, Director Warren, appreciate it. And my understanding is Parks Director Adina Long is next. Let's see, Director.
She was here a moment ago.
Hi, this is Adina Long, Director of Portland Parks and Recreation. I've only been on 8 calls today. You'd think I'd know where the mute button was. We're building our community resilience to the impacts of climate change, such as flooding, landslides, heat waves, and wildfire smoke, so that we can better on a good day and rebound faster on a bad day. Bureaus are assessing and making investments to reduce the risk to critical built infrastructure, natural systems, and outdoor workforces to episodes of extreme heat and flooding. Infrastructure bureaus continue to collaborate to develop a citywide resilience and recovery strategy and governance structures to establish investment priorities and enable a faster recovery after a natural hazard event. This includes advancing a pilot project concept to create an island of resilience centered around the East Portland Community Center, which will enable multiple infrastructure bureaus together with the community to test out new ways to collaborate and make targeted investments that build resilience. The COVID-19 crisis has shown us all how critical park facilities are in disaster response, and there are countless opportunities to improve the resilience of those facilities so they are available and functioning when we need them in a crisis. Next slide. We are also taking actions to protect, restore, and manage our urban natural resources to sequester carbon and build resilience to the impacts of climate change. Portland's natural systems provide important services to human physical and mental health. We must protect the value of natural ecosystems and biodiversity. In the coming year, the city will continue to prioritize tree protection, tree planting, and forest and natural area restoration and expansion. Portland Parks and Recreation manages 1.4 million park and street trees, trees that can both mitigate the impacts of climate change and reverse them. Long-term, as part of its efforts to build a sustainable future for our parks and recreation system, the city must aggressively care for and build its tree canopy. Bureaus are also working to increase natural flood storage on Portland's rivers and streams, including the Willamette and Columbia Rivers within the city limits. Bureaus will continue to take steps to protect threatened species, such as coho salmon, Chinook salmon, and steelhead trout. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Long. Next, we have Chief Administrative Officer, Mr. Tom Reinhart. Take it away.
Good evening, Council, colleagues, community members. My name is Tom Reinhart, for the record. I'm the city's Chief Administrative Officer. To achieve the aggressive climate goals that we are talking about tonight, we need to walk the talk by making bold investments needed so that the city-owned buildings, fleet, and operations become carbon neutral in the coming decade. Our bureaus are advancing various policies to ensure more climate-friendly operational decisions to achieve these goals. For example, we are adopting a suite of policies requiring bureaus to buy electric vehicles instead of gas or diesel-powered vehicles whenever possible, and requiring carbon offsets be purchased for city air travel. We are developing a strategy to accelerate the greening of the city's fleet, which will include powering some of our trucks with the renewable natural gas that will be produced from treating Portland's sewage. We will develop a climate test or carbon budget to guide our decision makers towards lower carbon choices, like purchasing more biofuels instead of fossil fuels, or using cement with lower embodied carbon. We will continue to purchase 100% renewable energy for city operations and seek opportunities to expand the installation of solar panels on city facilities. We will begin implementing an energy action plan for our buildings and will continue improving the efficiency of our operations, pumps, and other infrastructure systems. And with that, I believe I pass it back over to Director Durbin.
Thank you, directors. The climate emergency declaration you are considering today builds on Portland's important climate work over the past 25 plus years, but makes an intentional pivot towards not just measuring our success by how many tons of carbon we reduce, but moves us closer to a vision where success is also measured by how we are making people's lives better today, most especially those that have been denied the benefits of our past climate investments, programs, and policies. I'd like to introduce now our next speakers, Amanda Watson, Senior Policy Advisor with Mayor Wheeler's office, and Elisa Kane, the Climate Action Manager at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. They will be sharing more of the details on the Climate Emergency Declaration before you today. Thank you.
Director Durbin, thank you for that. Before we hear the staff presentation, we're a little bit behind schedule, and I know Chair Kafoury has a busy schedule this evening. So with everybody's forbearance, we'll have Chair Kafoury go before the staff presentation. Chair Kafoury, thanks for being with us this evening. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, and thank you for everyone who's on the call tonight. And my son just started playing the piano, so I apologize if you hear some scales in the background. But thank you again. My name is Deborah Kafoury, and I'm your Multnomah County Chair. And I'm here tonight because Multnomah County and the City of Portland have stood shoulder to shoulder for decades, calling for the world to take the climate crisis seriously. And beyond these calls, we have taken meaningful action. At Multnomah County, carbon emissions from our operations have decreased 64% during my time as chair, and our electricity now comes from wind and solar resources. We threw our support behind a remarkable group of young people suing the state of Oregon for a chance at a livable climate, making Multnomah County one of the first governments in the country to publicly support their cause. We joined with the city of Portland to declare our intention to move to 100% clean energy community-wide by 2050 and helped push PGE to embrace a future without fossil fuels. And carbon emissions across Multnomah County are now at 19% below 1990 levels. But we know that this has not been enough. We know because our community-wide emissions reductions have begun to plateau. We know because global emissions continue to rise. And we know because our forests are burning, threatening homes and blanketing our region in choking smoke. We know because our oceans are acidifying and our summers are hotter and drier. And we know because communities of color continue to be much likelier to live in hotter areas and breathe in more polluted air. Climate change is one of the biggest and most consequential crises we must deal with. But we can't understand any crisis without first understanding its root cause. And to look for the root of nearly any crisis in America, and you'll find a system of racist practices and policies that ultimately lead to disproportionate harm to communities of color. That's true for how historic and structural inequities place people of color at greater risk for the most serious effects of our current COVID-19 crisis. And it's also true for the climate crisis. If we're going to solve any of these complex, multidimensional problems, we must come to the table with comprehensive, multidimensional solutions. We can no longer hope that technocratic solutions aimed at reducing carbon emissions will solve this climate crisis without also addressing the underlying injustices in our community. To paraphrase Audre Lorde, we don't have single issue moments because we don't lead single issue lives. There is no climate justice without racial justice. So as long as our systems fail to recognize and protect the full humanity of people of color, we will fall short of doing what needs to be done in order to protect the future livability of our planet. Our 2015 Climate Action Plan broke important ground by focusing intentionally on equity, but we still have much more to do. Frontline community members and organizations are already leading the way, and it would be wise for both the county and the city to learn from their efforts and to follow their leads through collaborative partnership. And while we recognize the need to reorient and commit even deeper to this work, I am proud of some of the important actions that we've taken and the progress that we continue to make. Air quality and climate change are linked closely, particularly when we talk about the impact on our communities. And COVID-19 has added another painful dimension to the risks that our community, particularly BIPOC communities, face from chronic respiratory disease. Our work with the City of Portland and our other partners to finally address dirty diesel engines locally and at the state level will make a real difference in the lives and well-being of our community, particularly Black and Latinx people who are disproportionately impacted based on where they live. Having healthy people is the most critical factor of a climate resilient community. The county's racial and ethnic approaches to community health, or our REACH program, is addressing chronic diseases in the Black and African immigrant communities by addressing access to healthy foods and a just and more accessible transportation system. Starting with the Energy Justice Summit, we began important work with frontline community partners to ensure that our transition to a society powered by renewables moves forward in a way that is both led by and benefits vulnerable communities. I want to thank the City of Portland and the number of partners here today for your tireless efforts and advocacy. Our next chapter of climate action must harness the urgency of the moment, embrace this multidimensional understanding of the climate crisis, and center racial justice in our work to achieve climate justice. The scope and scale of the challenges that we're trying to address require deep collaboration, and I'm grateful that the county and the city are like-minded in our approach and our commitment to saving our future. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair Kapoor. We appreciate it. And as always, we appreciate the partnership with Multnomah County. Thank you for being here this evening.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from our staff presentation from Amanda Watson and Elisa Kane. Good evening.
Good evening, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Amanda Watson. I'm a senior policy advisor for Mayor Wheeler. I want to begin my remarks with a huge thank you to the community-based organizations and community leaders, especially our youth activists and organizations that are working to advance climate action and social justice, who called for the city to declare a climate emergency declaration and who worked with us over the past year to draft and refine this resolution. It's because of your leadership, activism, sustained engagement that we are here today with a climate emergency declaration that's focused on justice and that charts a new course for climate action in Portland. We'll hear from some of you this evening, and I want to thank all of you, and also to extend my thanks to those who weren't able to join us tonight. I know it's sometimes challenging in an evening. So we're a little bit behind, so I want to make sure we do have time to hear from our community speakers, so I'll keep this brief, but I'll give a very brief overview of the development of the Climate Emergency Declaration, and then I'll turn it over to Elisa Kane from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to take us through the details of the declaration. The City of Portland began drafting a Climate Emergency Declaration last summer in response to community advocacy. After hearing feedback from stakeholders, especially from youth advocates, that the first declaration wasn't strong enough, Mayor Wheeler directed the Bureau of Planning Sustainability staff to take additional time to engage with community members in the fall and winter of 2019 and to gather more feedback on what the declaration should look like. BPS staff spoke and met with close to 50 organizations and individuals. They prioritized outreach to BIPOC and youth-led organizations, and they used the feedback and recommendations from those conversations and meetings to prepare a new draft declaration, which we then released for public comment in February. We received close to 300 comments during the public comment period, and we incorporated that additional community feedback and input into the final version of resolution that City Council is considering today. To date, over 1,700 other jurisdictions have declared a climate emergency, but Portland's climate emergency declaration is different. We heard clearly from the community that Portland's climate emergency declaration needed to not only focus on updating our emissions reduction targets and identifying additional actions that the city would take to address climate change, but also to focus clearly on climate justice. As you've heard from previous speakers, the climate emergency declaration outlines what the city's new approach to climate action will look like, including our guiding values, priorities, and processes that we'll follow to take bold collective action to reduce carbon emissions and to build resilience to climate impacts using a climate justice approach. So I'll turn it over now to Elisa, who will take us through some of the details of the resolution before we hear from our invited testimony. Thank you.
Thanks, Amanda.
Good evening, Mayor and Commissioners.
Evening.
I am Elisa Kane, the Climate Action Manager with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I use she, her pronouns. We are at a pivotal juncture in our climate work. As Portland contends with COVID-19 and reckons with our racist history, we know that the climate crisis may be less visible, but as we understand, is no less deadly. The Climate Emergency Declaration is our moment to acknowledge that now is the time to do things differently. Through our engagement with community, we heard a lot of concern about the climate impacts we are already seeing in Portland. For some people, it's the unbearable summer heat or dangerous air quality from the burning of fossil fuels or wildfires. For others, it's that they spend a disproportionate amount of their income on energy bills because their home lacks insulation or efficient heating systems. We also know that there are people in Portland's neighborhoods that are without safe connections to mass transit or that there's no mass transit service at all. And for some Portlanders, the people they love in their homelands, be it near or far, are being forced to leave because of sea level rise, catastrophic wildfires, or because the unsustainable extraction of natural resources leaves them with no viable livelihood. The Climate Emergency Declaration that we're considering today is our attempt to recognize that climate change is not just a story of numbers and targets, but a story about people. It's Portland's first step to deeply consider the impacts of climate change on frontline communities and youth. We recognize frontline communities are Black, Indigenous people, communities of color, immigrants, refugees, low-income individuals, laborers and workers, people living with disabilities, youth, and individuals experience houselessness. In the Climate Emergency Declaration, we recognize that these frontline communities are often the communities least responsible for contributing to climate change and have also benefited the least from mitigation and adaptation investments. The Climate Emergency Declaration also acknowledges that Native nations prioritize the balance between a sustainable environment and the well-being of people, as they have done for this land since time immemorial, and will do so in perpetuity to preserve their culture and protect traditional lifeways. This resolution recognized that as we move away from an economy that is built off slavery, colonialism, and the unsustainable extraction of natural resources, the people from frontline communities must be the ones that benefit first from the transition to a clean energy economy and be able to lead the planning and implementation efforts to address climate change. In that spirit, the Climate Emergency Declaration also acknowledges the importance of community-led climate action and the resiliency of communities already impacted by climate change. The passage of the Portland Clean Energy Benefits Fund and the community-led work of Zero Cities demonstrates that the community has the knowledge, technical expertise, and lived experience to lead climate action in Portland, along with other community partners and government agencies. The Climate Declaration makes the connection between climate and social, racial, and environmental justice initiatives. For example, we understand that climate action is linked to issues that we are addressing throughout the city, including housing affordability, access to green infrastructure, air quality, equitable transportation and mobility, racial justice, and police profiling. As Director Warner mentioned, not everyone is safe on Portland streets. Portland's Walking While Black study highlights that Black Portlanders are more likely to be stopped by police when walking on the street. This means that a climate action strategy that suggests people walk to do their errands, we are not considering that we may be putting Black people in a potentially dangerous situation due to racism and police violence. This is our opportunity for climate action to look upstream at the systems and investments that prevent us from making meaningful progress on our climate goals. The climate emergency also recognized youth as leaders and advocates of climate justice and recognized workers and the needs for a just transition. So with that in mind, the Climate Emergency Declaration commits the city to important work ahead. To start, we will be setting up a new climate justice initiative with Multnomah County. For the 2015 Climate Action Plan, we developed our climate action by working with community members as advisors. Often the city and county would identify a potential climate action and then I ask the community for input on how we can make it more equitable. This model was an important shift in our work to the state and got us this far. Moving forward, we want to center frontline communities as equal partners to drive our work to produce equitable benefits for frontline communities that dramatically reduce carbon emissions. We also want to expand the table to include new voices, ones that represent frontline communities, specifically Black and Indigenous communities that haven't been at the table in the past. We will work with our partners to find funding to resource participation by these communities, and starting with a grant BPS received from the Bullitt Foundation. We will also coordinate with staff from the Anti-Displacement Plan team and other city initiatives to make sure we're expanding the table of engagement, but not burdening our community partners. The city and county are just starting to reach out to the community, and we will begin to launch this initiative sometime this fall. The Climate Emergency Declaration also commits us to new carbon emission targets. The recently completed analysis of our 2018 carbon emissions shows us that Portland's emissions are plateauing. We recognize the urgency of avoiding the catastrophic effects of climate change, so we're adopting a new target of achieving at least 50% reduction in carbon emissions below 1990 levels by 2030 and net zero carbon emissions before 2050. We got a lot of feedback that people wanted the city to adopt interim targets that get us to our goals even faster. And we want to be responsive to this request and ensure that our interim targets are based on the best available data on our local carbon emissions. So over the summer, BPS will be completing an analysis of pathways for decarbonization sector by sector that we plan to share through public workshops. With this information, we will create additional interim targets to be adopted when we return to City Council this fall with policies related to the mayor's climate commitments for government operations. The Climate Emergency Declaration also commits to supporting youth and youth-led climate action. We've already heard about the city's commitments to work with Metro and TriMet to find resources to fund a year-round transit pass for Portland youth. And we will also support the leadership of youth and youth-serving organizations, including Portland Public Schools, to host a youth climate summit, which will take place virtually this fall. Tonight, we heard from multiple bureau directors about the city's commitment to continuing cross-bureau collaboration on numerous fronts, including increasing green infrastructure and tree canopy, especially in East Portland, protecting and restoring floodplains, and supporting recovery of threatened and endangered species. In addition, the city commits to developing a citywide natural disaster resilience and recovery strategy that prioritizes frontline communities and disaster resilience. And finally, the city will adopt new policies that prevent further expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure and quicken the transition to clean, renewable fuel options that are also good for air quality. Finally, the Climate Emergency Declaration makes clear that we expect our utility partners to decarbonize their energy systems and prioritize the protection of low-income customers from rate increases. We've gone over a lot of information this evening, but this won't be the only time you'll hear from staff about this declaration. BPS plans to return to City Council with an update in early 2021 to share our progress on these commitments. So to close, I want to acknowledge and thank the people who are part of tonight's panel. Up next, you'll hear from some of our community partners and climate justice leaders who dedicated time and energy to providing input and feedback on the declaration. I want to personally thank them for their leadership and wisdom as we work through the various drafts of the declaration. As we've laid out, we have a lot of work to do and our time is running out. But this is a critical day for climate action in Portland. When we look back 27 years from now, we'll see that through this climate emergency declaration, we made an important decision, and that is to center the voices of people impacted the most and to creating equitable community benefits that deliver dramatic carbon emission reductions. This work won't be easy, and as we understand, asking critical questions about how we do this work may reveal injustices in a history that we'd rather forget. But if the past few months have shown us anything, Portland and the people who live here are resilient, and when working together, we can do hard things. Thank you.
Thank you, Elisa. Appreciate your presentation. Thank you, Amanda, as well. And with that, I'll turn it over to Director Durbin, who will introduce our invited testimony. Director Durbin.
Thank you, Mayor. We'd like to begin this evening with Don Sampson from the Affiliated Tribes of the Northwest Indians. Welcome.
Thank you, Andrea. Good to see you again. So glad you're working with the city. I had the opportunity and pleasure to work with Andrea on our legislation in the state of Oregon to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and really try to change the trajectory of where we're going. And I appreciate all the work that you're doing there, the city of Portland. I want to thank you, Mayor Wheeler, city council members, and Amanda Watson, as well as Alyssa Kane, for really reaching out to engage tribal people in providing input to this very important declaration. I also want to thank Lord John, who's the tribal liaison, a good friend of mine. All of those folks were able to come to our tribal climate camp, which was held on the Salish Kootenai Indian Reservation last summer. I think it's important. I grew up in Portland as a young man. I'm calling you from the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Pendleton, Oregon. And Mayor Wheeler, we've met many times, and you've been to many events. You've supported tribal people, as well as City Councilwoman Amanda Fritz. We thank you so much. It's ATNI, as you know, is a consortium of over 50 tribes in the Northwest, including all 9 tribes of Oregon. We also work with many of the intertribal organizations in the Portland area. We recognize that it's important that the city acknowledge the sovereign governments, the 9 sovereign governments who have been here since time immemorial. And as you know, the city of Portland, as well as the affiliated tribes and the Portland Clean Energy Fund Initiative, were one of 10 finalists for the American Climate Leadership Award. So congratulations, City of Portland and the tribes, ETNI, for leading the nation. As I read through and had the opportunity to read the resolution and the declaration, I was very pleased that the city acknowledged the impacts our people have had. And I'm speaking about not only the indigenous tribes from this area, but also the indigenous people who have lived in Portland. You know, during the time when I was growing up, I'm 59 years old, there was what they call a relocation plan where they moved many of our communities from the reservation into the cities to try to find jobs. This relocation effort displaced many of our people. But today, the population of Portland, the Portland metro area, is comprised of many, many different tribal people, tribal nations from all backgrounds across this great country. And it's very exciting to know that the city of Portland recognizes that responsibility, the respect, honors
the sovereignty of these tribes and the tribal people. For years, we have taken care of this land, the river, the Willamette, the Blue River, very sacred river for our people. And now this place that we call Portland, we know it has been our home thousands and thousands of generations. And it has been because of our wisdom of these leaders and this traditional law we call Tamanwit, the law that our Creator has given this land to recognize, to take care of, to be thinking many generations into the future for the seventh generation. That is who we are. But today, you all stand together, all people of color, all people of different communities, to take a stand for what is right and important. It is our spiritual and moral duty to the Creator and to this law that we follow, our Indigenous people, to always protect and preserve this earth, our mother. And so the resolution, I believe, finally acknowledges the importance of all people and the importance of this land. You know, I grew up in Columbia Villa when I was a kid. I lived on Savis Island. I was poor, and I did not understand the importance of what my father, the chief of the Walla Walla tribe, was teaching me, or my grandmother, the importance of the food that we survive on. But today's declaration moves us forward together. And so I'm very honored to be able to support this and let you know that there are tribal people working together with the city. That is the key. I know that there's a lot of talk in this resolution about the whereases, but make sure and certain that as we get to the resolves and the actions where you call on partners and stakeholders, recognize that the nine tribes of Oregon are not stakeholders, they are sovereign governments, and that the tribal community must have an active role as frontline. And I know that that is your intent. We trust that you will do that, as well as all of our partners in Portland. I also want to acknowledge there's an action item coming up as we work on climate. There's an opportunity here, and you might have heard about this, with the OMSI district. It's the Center for Tribal Nations at the OMSI district, and it represents a major milestone for the Native community in Oregon and the larger Pacific Northwest. Before European colonization, the confluence of the Willamette and Columbia hosted permanent Native settlements and annual seasonal rounds for our people. And now, after many years, and I lived there for over 30, 40 years, we tried to build a center for our people to gather. And now we have that opportunity. The Center for Tribal Nations is envisioned as a integrated packages of buildings, infrastructure, and riverfront restoration to finally meaningfully restore the Native community's connection to the Willamette while modeling a new relationship focused on collaboration to promote innovative solutions to shared challenges of sustainability, resilience, and inclusion shared by Native and non-Native people alike. So Mayor Wheeler, members of the City Council, now is our time for action. This project, the Center for Tribal Nations, the work with Native communities and the tribal governments of Oregon, together we can make it happen. So I appreciate all of you who are on the call today for the strength of our community of Oregonians, Portlandians, and Native people across this country. We look forward to the challenge and the hard work ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Donna. We appreciate your continued partnership, and thank you for being on with us tonight.
Thank you. Next, we will hear from Taryn Evans from the Coalition of Communities of Color. Taryn, thank you.
Good evening, Mayor Wheeler, commissioners. My name is Taryn Evans, and I currently serve as Environmental Justice Director at the Coalition of Communities of Color. This declaration and this work have particular significance to me and intersect with my personal life and my career trajectory. Almost exactly 7 years ago, while a graduate student in Portland State University's Master of Urban and Regional Planning program, I started interning at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I had the opportunity to work closely with staff on integrating equity considerations within the Climate Action Plan. We work closely with an equity working group of six community-based organizations to get feedback on proposed plan actions. In meeting after meeting, the group provided valuable feedback. Feedback that, when presented to staff, caused them to significantly rethink actions and modify them accordingly. The members of the Equity Working Group were able to provide a lens and perspective that cannot be learned from coursework alone, but the results from years of lived experience, from living the impacts of, and not just studying the climate crisis. I reflect on what would have been different if we started with, rather than were advised by, community. Yet the work that was done was by no means insignificant and represented an important stepping stone that illuminated the vital role of community in climate action planning. Community lived experience and knowledge must never be viewed as secondary. It must be at the forefront of all of our work. Fortunately, in this city, we have a strong example of what happens when frontline communities lead the way. In 2018, the Portland Clean Energy Initiative passed. PSEF was the first ballot initiative created for and led by communities of color to fund climate justice and jobs in the United States. Despite well-resourced opposition and claims of political infeasibility, the initiative overwhelmingly passed. I think that this highlights an interesting point. We don't always know what is possible. Our imaginations are constrained by the way that things have always been, but we don't always know how events will unfold in the world and how things will change. Years ago, when working on the 2015 Climate Action Plan, I could not have imagined the moment that we are in right now. In the midst of a global pandemic and a reckoning with 400 years of systemic oppression of Black people in this country, circumstances have radically changed. The world is not as it was 5 years ago when the Climate Action Plan was adopted. The world isn't even as it was 4 months ago. We must meet this moment of monumental change with innovative solutions and not with prescriptive outcomes that presuppose what those solutions will be. We must be willing to try things that we never tried before, knowing that the old way of doing things isn't working. We meet it by taking bold action, reshifting power, and centering the communities most impacted. We have the opportunity to lead the way right now and serve as a model for what community-led change can look like. I sincerely hope that we are ready to meet this moment and reimagine what climate action looks like. Thank you.
Thank you, Taryn. We appreciate your work on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Taryn. Next, we will hear from Oriana Magneta from Verde.
Good evening, Mayor Wheeler, commissioners. For the record, my name is Oriana Magnera. I use she, her pronouns, and I am a registered lobbyist representing Verde. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Verde builds environmental wealth for communities through organizing, advocacy, and social enterprise, and we are testifying in favor of item 511, the Climate Emergency Declaration, this evening. I'd like to begin, perhaps unexpectedly, by asking what is the value of a climate emergency declaration? The climate crisis is an emergency whether we declare it so or not, and is especially urgent for Black and Brown communities who have borne the burden of pollution, extreme weather, health and wealth disparities, racism, and other effects that draw not only from the climate crisis, but from the crises of capitalism, racism that is especially anti-Black and anti-Indigenous, and colonialism. But these things have not been named as such until they affect white communities with greater income, wealth, power, and privilege, until a team of scientists have declared that we have barely a decade to change. Suddenly, the crisis is crystallized. It is in sharp relief. It is emergent. We do not, at its base, need a climate emergency declaration to capture this. But then what is the value? Why is Verde, along with other advocates, supporting this action today? We are here in support to urge that this not just be nominal action. Too often we recognize problems, we draw attention to a front line and then turn our spotlight towards other fights, and similarly are not new and fade into dark as we swing the lens around and around. But we must light up the whole plane of injustice and hold steady focus on each disparity and the snarled intersections that bind them. Verde is here in support because, while imperfect, the item before you for consideration is strong in its illumination and contains many elements that were informed or written by organizations such as mine that directly represent environmental justice communities. I would like to commend the strong work of Elisa Kane, supported by strong work from Amanda Watson, to listen, to learn, and to act. And the city would do a disservice to them and to the testifiers and our communities today if it does not take this as an opportunity to do the same. More importantly, this work first must be resourced through budgets and through city appropriations and acquisition. I would like to thank Tom Reinhart for speaking today and for the inclusion of the Office of Management and Finance in this work. We see much attention paid to other bureaus that interface more directly with community, but we must also create stronger connections between OMF and the organizations like Faraday and more directly to community to better influence how our city does this work, not just through policy and programs, but through its functions and operations. We must also change how decisions are made, and Verde is excited about the opportunity afforded by the Declaration to create a new structure through which community can lead in climate policy, supported by a partnership between government and the foundation community. To reach emissions reductions and systemic change that we must achieve in order to repair, restore, and regenerate, it will require reorientation of power to those who have been most harmed, most oppressed, and are most able to offer strong solutions because they see the problems without being obscured by the benefits that white people with power, such as myself, receive from business as usual. Many people have named that in this moment of COVID, we cannot say that we should return to normal, that this is a time for the momentous change we need to tear down and transform. I want to thank Director Durbin for naming the Zero Cities Project as an example of the kind of work that could be advanced through commitment to this climate emergency declaration. This project was initially framed as a roadmap toward net zero buildings, but because it's become an opportunity to operationalize the kind of community-led policymaking that this declaration solidifies. That space has renamed itself as Build Shift because the community members who are leading the work are grounded in dreaming up and then creating the future they want to see, to know, and to live. The value of an emergency climate declaration is not that it acknowledges things that frontline communities see clearly, know intimately, and live daily, but that it creates a doorway toward an alternate future. I will end my testimony today by quoting activist and organizer Adrienne Marie Brown. All organizing is science fiction. We are bending the future together into something we have never experienced. A world where everyone experiences abundance, access, pleasure, human rights, dignity, freedom, transformative justice, peace. We long for this. We believe it is possible. The value of a climate emergency declaration is not that it states what is or has been, but because it invites us to dream what is possible. Thank you for this time, your evening, and thank you for your support of this item.
Thank you, Ariana. Thank you for your work and the work of Verde. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ariana. Next, we'll hear from Jennifer Jo Kane from 350 PDX. Jennifer, welcome.
You're muted, Jennifer. There you go.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity to give testimony today. My name is Jennifer Jo Kane, and I'm a volunteer with 350 PDX. The forces that cause climate change show up in people's lives in the form of asthma rates, displacement, and increasingly militarized police forces. With the COVID-19 pandemic and protests for Black lives have laid bare is how disproportionately these forces are felt by Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. We are living in a lightning rod time history, which legal scholar and civil rights attorney Michelle Alexander describes as a deciding moment in our democracy. The effects on Portlanders of the climate crisis are shaped by systemic racism in our city. The Climate Emergency Declaration can be a tool for the city to address the historic and current environmental racism against BIPOC in Portland. As the Climate Emergency Declaration rightly points out, Portland has a long history of racist practices and policies that have excluded, marginalized, displaced, and terrorized BIPOC communities. And the impacts of this white supremacist system and culture continue to this day. For the past several weeks, I've been researching more details about the racist and white supremacist history of our community here in Portland to help inform my work as a climate activist in the community. The details, statistics, and data I found were alarming and unfortunately not surprising. In the interest of saving time and being mindful of my other presenters, I've prepared a written testimony as an addendum to my spoken testimony that I will be submitting tomorrow, focused in on the history of racism in Portland and how this impacts the work on climate emergency declaration. I will share this with you all via email tomorrow, and I encourage you to see it as a part of my testimony. Moving forward, the scale of change that is needed to address the climate crisis cannot be achieved unless racist policies that wage war on BIPOC bodies are replaced by anti-racist policies. We see the Climate Emergency Declaration as a critical opportunity for this type of policy, as long as it is indeed fully funded so that frontline community members can participate. We are also encouraged by the commitments to partner with and resource frontline communities in work on decarbonization research and policy that benefits them, as mentioned in resolutions number 16 and 17. We also are encouraged to see in the final draft acknowledgement of climate change's impact on worker safety, the impact of diesel emissions on health, support for the Youth Pass for All that was mentioned today, and a commitment to protecting and enhancing tree canopy, especially in East Portland. I want to highlight the fact that funds requested by BPS to hire a staff member for the Climate Emergency Declaration was not granted, and for this to be reconsidered in the light of the climate emergency and considering the disparate impact on BIPOC communities. Two, it is not enough to mitigate the harms that the city's climate actions cause to Portland's communities of color. Climate actions must not only result in real emissions reductions, but in concrete benefits for BIPOC communities. Offsets, renewable energy credits, and utility company schemes create a mirage of climate solutions without real local investments. False solutions such as these must be discarded in favor of those that advance energy, democracy, and climate justice. And we see the commitment to community-based renewable energy in resolution number 31 as an important step. And lastly, there are so many things that we could put in place to affect positive change at the city level. Give access to transportation to youth and low-income BIPOC communities by making it free and safe. To curtail gentrification incentives and practices, defunding police and carceral programs, funding programs and enacting policies to ameliorate displacement, assist Black families to keep and upgrade their homes, help Black businesses with funding and technical support, plus job training programs, training in green and low carbon jobs. Workers, especially that have been affected with COVID, have been Black women that have suffered the greatest loss of jobs in the last 4 months. Funding schools through means that don't rely on property taxes to the disadvantage of poor Black and brown neighborhoods. Provide scholarships for low-income BIPOC people and low-income women from all groups to attend community college and state colleges and universities. Investing in affordable housing units, which are also critical to address the high rate of homelessness. Staff mental health services and domestic violence programs with mental health, social work, and community health professionals to strengthen the safety net and protect Black, Indigenous, people of color lives. Our organization at 350 is mostly white, and we acknowledge we have failed to show up for the daily fight against racial injustice. We need to not just acknowledge that white supremacist culture exists, but do the hard detail work of dismantling it from within ourselves and our organizing. This means prioritizing anti-racism and dismantling white supremacy work within our policies, practices, and culture, and advocating doing the inner and outer work to move towards climate justice. We believe that this Climate Emergency Declaration is an important shift for the city in its climate action, and we will be here every step of the way to ensure implementation lives up to its words. The great poet and writer Maya Angelou said, "Do the best you can, then when you know better, do better." No point in time is our better needed more than now. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. We appreciate it. And we'll look forward to getting your email tomorrow then. Thank you for that too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jennifer. Next, we'll hear from Ella Schreiner from the Portland Youth Climate Council. Welcome, Ella.
Hi, Ella.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Ella Schreiner, and I'm representing the Portland Youth Climate Council.
And my name is Peter Salinger, and I'm also here representing the Portland Youth Climate Council.
And before I begin, I just wanted to acknowledge and thank the other community organizers and representatives that have already spoken today. Your work and words truly inspire me today and every day. The city first came to the Portland Youth Climate Council with the idea of the Climate Emergency Declaration last summer. We wanted to hold off on supporting it until we were sure that the declaration had clear goals that would make a positive impact on climate policy and action. Later, in the fall, when youth striked for the climate, one of the demands was that the city wait to declare an emergency until community members, especially youth and communities of color, had had an adequate input. Today, the Portland Youth Climate Council is here in support of the declaration. We would like to thank the city for all the work that has gone into this resolution, in particular Amanda Watson and Lisa Kane for working with us, listening to our input and reflecting it in the declaration. During this process, we have felt that we as youth were included and that our voices were being heard, and we appreciate that immensely. We've been very encouraged by the many improvements made to the Climate Emergency Declaration in the past months and appreciate the work that your teams have put into incorporating community feedback and recognizing the need to center frontline voices. However, we feel that there are places where it can be improved. The IPCC report indicates, and numerous climate scientists and experts agree, that this next decade is a crucial period for reducing our carbon emissions and climate impact. If we do not make the necessary reductions in emissions by 2030, we will see irreparable damage to our planet, impacting our most vulnerable communities first and foremost. For this reason, it is clear that 2050 is far too distant a goal for carbon neutrality. A date that is 30 years in the future allows us to continue postponing the strong, immediate action that is required of us. A recent study by UC Berkeley has found that a transition to 90% renewable electricity across the entire US by 2035 is not only feasible, but affordable. The country is barely beginning these types of changes and is far behind where we need to be, even looking at the IPCC numbers. Portland needs to take on more to help make up for this. Our world literally depends on it. In this resolution, the City of Portland should commit to reaching carbon neutrality before 2035, rather than 2050, with a commitment to a minimum of 8% reductions each year to ensure that we stay on track. We have emailed you all our proposed language for these amendments, and we ask again that you include this amendment in today's resolution. At the very least, we ask that the city require a yearly decrease in emissions in order to be better held accountable. A major step in achieving this goal is using the right sources of energy. This resolution lacks a clear specification of what renewable energy is. Language about natural gas is used in a clause that talks about renewable energy goals. This is unacceptable. Renewable natural gas is not a clean fuel. It is both environmentally destructive and damaging to our atmosphere. In the age of the climate crisis, we cannot afford to have the City of Portland putting its credibility behind the greenwashing of this fuel. We ask that this be clarified. We also ask that today the city adds language in the declaration committing itself to developing a strategy to oppose the expansion of Portland's natural gas infrastructure. By investing in more fossil fuel infrastructure, we commit to decades of future use, which we cannot afford.
As youth, we will be more affected by climate change than most. I began this fight in eighth grade when I spoke at a press conference with Commissioner Fritz and former Mayor Charlie Hales before the passage of the No Oil Trains resolution and the No New Fossil Fuel Infrastructure resolution. I could barely see over the podium. I will leave for college this fall. In the years since Ella and I began working on this issue, there have been many wins. The No Oil Trains resolution and the No New Fossil Fuel Infrastructure resolution and the 100% renewable energy resolution and, if all goes as planned, the Climate Emergency Declaration will have passed through this council during that time. You have the framework that you need to make real change. Use it. When people ask us what the city has done to fight climate change, we can't point to our resolutions. We must be able to point to the actions that we have taken that were outlined in our resolutions. The people who worked on this declaration truly care about the planet. When youth and others had concerns about it originally, it was because the declaration needed to be the best that it could be. But there is only so far that we can take it. The next phase of this work begins after this vote. We need the city to follow through so that we can see real drops in our emissions. The city must do the right thing even when there are no organizations to push it. Behind the scenes, we need people at the city to be approaching all of their work like we are in a climate emergency, because we are. This declaration is a great step forward. There are many more to go and many that won't have public hearings like this one. In the last 5 years of our work on the environment, the city has come a long way. I trust that the people who wrote this declaration and the people who are voting on it today are truly dedicated to the words it contains. Let's not just be a city of plans. Let's be a city that takes these plans and acts with commitment and with courage. Thank you.
Thank you both. We appreciate it.
Excellent. Thank you both.
Commissioner Hardesty had her hand raised. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. I just wanted to appreciate Ella, and I'm sorry, I didn't remember the young man's name.
Peter.
Thank you both, Ella. It's frightening to think that you're on your way to college, because you've been such a strong advocate for this work for so long. I can't wait for you to come back and take over, because we'll be ready for you by then when you get out of college. Thank you both very much for your testimony. I want to ask you a bit about what your recommendation was, and I certainly understand why you are recommending that we just set a number as far as 8% reduction per year. I can certainly understand why you would want to set a very specific number. Did you hear back from the work group why they thought that was not something that they could commit to at this time?
We have not heard.
We did actually hear a little bit, and our understanding was that the idea is that you're meeting the what's required through the IPCC report and other agreements that Portland has signed on to, and we're kind of coming at it as we can't just be doing the bare minimum or just what's required of us. We need to be going above and beyond and kind of making up for other cities that are not doing as much as they should be.
And I really appreciate it. Thank you for that. I really appreciated your statement about the utilities, because I'm very concerned that we are holding up utilities as if they're going to solve our climate crisis. And we know that they're not going to be the ones to do it. It's going to be clean energy, real clean energy, that's going to help us actually mitigate the damage that's being done. And so I am hopeful that I've talked to Director Durbin about my concerns about that language, because it appears that utilities are leading the way, and I would say they're just an obstacle to all of us getting to a cleaner, green future. And so I'm hopeful that there's some language that we can come up with around, especially around the utility piece. And I want to make a commitment that this is not a dead document once we pass it. I have an expectation that we're going to be revisiting this at least on an annual basis, if not more, to see where we are and where we can push more. So I don't want you to think after the vote today that we're done and we're going to pat ourselves on the back, because we have to do more and we have to do better and we have to challenge ourselves to do more. I think there's a desire to commit to what we know is possible right now, but as you know, the entire world has changed since we started this resolution. So I hope in your free time from school that you will keep checking in with us to make sure that we're on the right path. But I want you to know that we're all committed to continuing this conversation. This is the beginning of our work. It's not the end of our work. So thank you both. And good luck at school. What school are you going to?
Carleton College in Minnesota.
Excellent. How about you?
Attending Whitman College in Walla Walla.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, both of you go off, be brilliant, and come back and take our jobs, please.
Thank you. Thank
you. We got to do a better sales pitch than that, Commissioner Hardesty. Thank you both. Excellent testimony. We, of course, wish you all the very best in your college endeavors. Director Durbin.
Thank you. And we'll move to our last panelist for the invited testimony, and that is Desiree Williams-Raji with Capua Consulting. Desiree, great to have you here this evening.
Thanks so much, Andrea, and thanks so much, Mayor and Commissioners, for having me join you here tonight. And I am so honored to be the final speaker and actually was listening to the other comments. Just want to thank all of the other speakers and panelists tonight for what they brought up in terms of the issues that our communities are facing and how this emergency declaration both acknowledges what has already been known, but also in terms of the commitment of government, the city of Portland, to really move something forward. And to name these issues that we've known for a long time to be an emergency. What I wanted to do actually, so many of you actually already know me because I used to work in the city of Portland. I used to work with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and actually also with Taryn, who spoke earlier. And I was the equity program manager with the Climate Action Plan in 2015. I wanted to actually talk a little bit about how momentous this occasion is on kind of a national scale and the national leadership that Portland is putting forward today. So in 2015, when we adopted the Climate Action Plan, we did something rather unprecedented. And to what Taryn had mentioned, it really was because of this partnership that we had had with community-based organizations. But within that Climate Action Plan, we named something. We named that institutional racism was a barrier to advancing climate change or climate action. And getting to our carbon neutrality goals. And that in and of itself actually created a new standard. It created a new bar for people in government, in sustainability, working on climate action plans across the country. They wanted to understand what this was that we were doing, because in sustainability, we have this notion of the triple bottom line, where it's equity, economy, and the environment. But in the field, the path towards equity was really unknown. And so the work that we had done on that climate action plan actually unlocked this thing, this invisible thing that we all knew was true, but nobody could name it. Nobody had named it. And so in 2015, that was our win. It quickly became not enough. And 5 years later, now that we're in 2020, so much has changed and so much has been talked about in the last 4 months, our world has changed. And so in that, this moment right here is an opportunity to move forward into doing something completely new and innovative and redefining where that bar is for the nation to move forward. That excites me. That excites me because today I'm actually a consultant. I no longer work with the city, and I'm working with cities and jurisdictions across the United States and across Canada. And they're looking for what's this next step? How do we approach this practice? What is the direction that we go? And I knew that Portland would be able to meet that expectation and far exceed it. And so I wanted to talk about four areas very quickly that I saw this happen. So the first one was actually the development of the resolution. You saw kind of this wave happen across the country where everyone was like, I want to be doing a climate emergency resolution, like climate, or everyone was doing it, like cities all in Canada too, and all around the world. And then Portland then said, we're up, we got to do ours. And there was pushback. There was pushback from the community that said, wait, we need to have a conversation. Just like Ella said, we need to do this right. And Portland listened. And it took the time to really do the listening and the thinking of how to get this declaration to be something that really represented what the community needed in order to advance the work in the direction it's supposed to. This was really different than the rest of the country. And in fact, I saw climate emergency declarations where mayors had put them forward interrupt the equity and justice work that those cities and communities had been moving forward on in the name of something that was a brand around a climate emergency declaration, which reoriented all of this community-based work to something else. And what I see here is actually the opportunity to elevate and advance the partnerships, the focus on youth, the focus on Indigenous people, that this actually is naming a new reality that we need to move forward in a new way of advancing this work. And so I want to just have appreciation for the time to slow down. And that's actually what we need to do this work correctly. Even though in its urgency, we want to move forward fast. And there's a saying that you move slow to go fast. And in this case, I think that's absolutely what this emergency declaration is helping to set up. Another thing that I've seen in this work is that we start with this term equity, climate equity. And even in the 2015 plan, what we named was climate equity, but today we're talking about climate justice.
And anytime I see a transition from the word equity to justice, what I notice is that what's an adoption is more of an identity of the entity in saying that that actually is who we are. And so what I look forward to, and that I hope all the community members will be looking to hold the city accountable to, is the city actually holding up an identity that is a justice identity? Because the justice identity actually calls for more than just an equity lens. It actually calls for solutions that are economic in nature, to change the economy that we're operating in, to actually have very different outcomes that are not oppressive. The other thing that I thought that would be important to call out was the approach of the resolution itself, which is not always true in these resolutions because they become this litany of just actions. And so I wanted to name that actually talking about how you were going to do this and doing it in such an intentional way with the community, how critical that actually is. The piece around centering frontline communities, the piece around collaborating within government, actually break down silos, but also collaboration with the community, transparency of information, the commitment for resources, and the commitment to shift power dynamics. Those are such critical ingredients to the work that we're doing, and that is very focused on what the responsibility of government actually is. The last piece I wanted to talk about was actually a commitment to innovation, that we don't know exactly what the answers are going to be moving forward. We don't know because we have nothing, no framework by which we're pulling from in order to do these, to create these solutions. And so in order to do that, we have to create new ways of finding them. And what's named in the Climate Emergency Declaration and was alluded to by Oriana and Taryn is really something that is coming out in national best practice and research around the creation of third space, the creation of a space that doesn't inherit the dysfunctional power dynamics with community that exists within government, but actually a commitment to third space places where you can design new solutions together. And so in that, this idea of designing and creating third space together, the possibility of what can come from that is just immense. And so I applaud the city of Portland, I applaud Elisa Kane, I applaud Amanda Watson for the thinking that has gone behind, the intention that has gone behind the development of this resolution, and to be able to move something that, again, will set a new bar for the rest of the country. And really, it's about not accepting the status quo, not accepting business as usual, even when the city of Portland set the standard for climate action planning and climate work, to not accept that as good enough, and to say that the better aspect of this, us moving forward and our new level, has to be to address racism, has to be to address injustice. And that is the work that we have to move forward. So I look forward to continuing to support the city of Portland from outside the city now, in helping and figuring out ways to really move this critical work forward, and really for us to see new outcomes and changes that we've long been awaiting for. So thank you all. Thank you for doing this work, and thank you for being in the work.
Thank you, Desiree. We appreciate your being here with us this evening. I see Commissioner Hardesty has her hand raised. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Desiree. What a pleasure to have you back here and talking to us in Portland, because your leadership has really launched us on the path to really start thinking critically about the role that race played in climate and climate mitigation. And so I'm very grateful that you took the time to be with us tonight. You said something that really got me thinking when you talked about the shift that the city of Portland has made from equity around climate mitigation to climate justice, which is as different as night and day in my mind when you're talking about what's equitable and what's just and fair, right? Are there models in other parts of the country that you look at and go, well, gosh, if Portland just would like adopt this, they would be like the gold standard across the planet. Are you seeing activities that you think are promising practices that we should pay closer attention to?
There are. And actually, there's been what I was talking about earlier is a process of collaborative governance. Yeah. And what this is kind of acknowledging the design of our governmental systems are actually designed to perpetuate racism? And are there ways to commit community and government to different outcomes that are actually not racist outcomes in the design? And so models that stand out actually are in Providence, Rhode Island, and Seattle, of course, but their models actually were iterations of our model. So it's really interesting how these things kind of come full circle. But right. Providence's model, they started an environmental justice work group and spent 2 years really working with the community on a community-driven process to make recommendations to the city, rather than the city asking for input from the community to figure out what needed to be done to address carbon emission reduction. And I think for the city of Portland, I think we can actually go another step where there's a collaborative process, because I see the opportunity that you need to build the infrastructure inside the city to operate very differently. Having something from the outside just say for it to work differently won't make it different if the work isn't already happening inside the city. So I think that there are things to kind of iterate further on. But Providence has sort of leapfrogged the progress that we made in 2015. Washington, D.C. is looking at new models. Boulder County is looking at new models now for this collaborative governance process. It really centers the community leadership of frontline communities in naming and leading the innovative work of climate justice.
So one of my fears when I hear the city of Portland say over and over again that we're centering frontline communities and we're going to, I think the term was resource frontline communities, is it's not a simple process. And I'm concerned that we are promising deliverables that may not be what the community thinks those deliverables are. Because just reading those words makes me concerned that we are setting ourselves up to not meet the objectives that have been laid out in the resolution. I know that we use words sometimes as placeholders, but I am concerned at what the models that you mentioned that were promising, how are those models resourced, and are they resourced, and what does that look like?
I'm so glad you asked that question, and it's been a topic of conversation actually quite a bit in the Climate Justice Initiative, which is really the role of foundations. But I also think there's also a role for the private sector. As I mentioned, I think when you move from equity to justice, the implication really is in new economic models, which has a lot to do with where that funding comes from. So I'm looking forward to the innovation there. But to your question about where is funding coming from, a lot of these models are actually working through kind of a trifecta model with foundations playing a role. So Seattle very much had foundations playing a neutralizing role between the power of government and community, where it wasn't just government funding community, but rather government's role was to partner in finding other resources, because there are dynamics related to funding. Government and community. So there is the, I think, room for thinking really creatively about outside funding structures for this work to move forward. And the philanthropy community has been a resource for many of these cities to play that role.
I really appreciate hearing that, because as you know, every government is facing devastating budget shortfalls. And I do not want to give the impression that somehow we have money in our general fund that we're going to resource a whole lot of frontline communities, right? I mean, I would want to know more about what that looks like. And I'm sure we'll get into that process about how we make sure that the table really reflects the diversity of the community. Because my experience in Portland has been that we tend to have one organization that represents a race of people, and that just doesn't work at all. As if that's the kind of representation, if you're looking for real representation, that won't do it. So thank you. You've given me some really good insight. Again, great to see you again, and thanks for helping us with this.
Great to see you.
Thank you, Desiree. Thank you, Commissioner. Before we move on to public testimony, and I thank everybody for their patience, we are running way behind. Commissioner Fritz has her hand raised. Commissioner Fritz.
Yeah, I just have a brief something to say. I don't know if Desiree Williams-Raji is going to be before us in the next 6 months, and I need to honor you for the work that you did establishing the Office of Equity and Human Rights, that you were one of the five foundational women with Amalia Alaconda Morris and Afifa Ahmed Shafi and Dora Perry, who coincidentally retired from the Bureau of Development Services today. And Danielle Brooks, who as of tomorrow will be the only one of the five of you who's still working for the Office of Equity and Human Rights now. You set the direction for the city to be where we are today. I appreciated the reminder that in 2015 that work had already begun, and I hope that you will continue to guide the city for the foreseeable future. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. And with that, Director Durbin, I assume that completes the presentation as well as the invited panel. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mayor.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. I want to offer a friendly amendment to my own amendment. I got one word wrong that slightly changes my intent. So if you'll bear with me for a moment. Should I read the full text with the changed word, or
can we get a opinion from legal counsel, please?
Yes, please read the full text. Thank you. Okay. My apologies, everyone.
No worries, go ahead.
Be it resolved that since freeway expansions disproportionately harm communities of color and increase carbon emissions, the City of Portland will require demand management, including congestion pricing, implemented equitably and in close collaboration with BIPOC communities before, that's the changed word, any future freeway construction or expansion project. And the reason for that is that it is my strong belief, and what we're seeing on our roadways now bears it out, that we must do a much better job at managing demand on our existing infrastructure before we invest in expanding freeways.
Second, and I assume that you then are withdrawing your original amendment. And
oh, yes. I'd like to withdraw.
Terrific. Good. All right. So now we get to the part that many people have been waiting for, public testimony. Thank you all for your patience. This has been really riveting testimony, and so I appreciate everybody sticking around for it. Carla, I understand we have about 20-ish people signed up. Is that correct?
I'm sure about 13 are on the line right now, Mayor.
Okay, 2 minutes each, please. Name for the record, since there's only 13 people, if you go a little bit over, I don't think anybody's going to complain. I certainly won't. And just make sure you state your name for the record. And if you are a lobbyist, of course, as we mentioned up front, you have to disclose that as well. Carla, go ahead and read the first name.
The first person is Tri Sanger.
Good evening.
Looks like you may be muted. There you go.
My name is Tri Sanger, and I'm testifying on behalf of Extinction Rebellion PDX. I use they, them pronouns. This climate emergency declaration is groundbreaking in providing a framework for our local government to work in conjunction with community organizations, with Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and youth-led groups taking the lead to tackle one of the most significant global challenges facing us. However, as a young person whose life and generation will be heavily impacted, I am deeply concerned that to declare an emergency and then set a 2050 goal for problematic net zero emissions is an outrage. Net zero still allows for pollution offsets, and 2050 is far too late. The city needs to start today in this document to ensure that there are annual concrete action steps towards carbon emission reductions in the range of 10% each year. We stand with the Portland Youth Climate Council and their proposed goal of 2035. If the COVID crisis has shown us anything, it is that when there is clear evidence of lethal threats, early bold actions save lives and decrease the human and socioeconomic costs. We must follow the science. Each new report shows climate chaos escalating at rates far faster than anticipated. Now there is little hope of holding global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which would result in the early death of millions. It is quite possible we are on a path towards a rise of 5 degrees Celsius instead of the 3 degrees originally feared. Arctic warming is proceeding at twice the global warming average, and just last week it was over 100 degrees in the Arctic Circle. Scientists say that one of the tipping point indicators, the blue ocean event, or the complete absence of Arctic ice, is likely to occur by the end of this year or next, and there are plenty of feedback loops that have not even begun to operate. We need to act now. This declaration is stronger on process than on substance. We need more concrete decarbonization strategic steps that will act faster with annual accountability measures. The city needs to act more boldly on decarbonization, and Extinction Rebellion hopes to work with you and other community groups to identify and implement concrete steps quickly. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy.
Next is Edith Gillis.
Evening, Edith. Do you see Edith on the list here?
I see Edith, but she looks like she's muted.
Oh, Edith, can you unmute?
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can. Thank you. Good evening.
Fund, promote, require, and care for planting more trees in quantity, diversity, and just distribution, and reliably and vigorously enforce with heavy fines, expropriation, jail of guilty decision makers, and mitigation for increasing photosynthesis, carbon sequestration, stormwater management, air cooling, and social justice. Each year, the same size, the same species of tree will sequester and photosynthesize less and less and less because of drought, heat, air pollution, and the clogged stomata. So we must have increased the trees we have and make sure that they're distributed more justly around the city. Two, divest from and outlaw within city limits known chemical, sound, and heat harm to climate, respiratory health, public safety, and social justice, including but not limited to tear gas, CS, pepper spray, and other chemical or sound weapons permanently within this month. B, frack gas and other sources of methane hookups for new and remodeled structures by January 2021, and any pipeline or burning of use within the city by January 2025, with Northwest Natural Gas and other current companies clean up their infrastructure and provide energy efficient electrical alternatives for low-income families. C, ban all oil bomb trains, shale oil, tar sands, crude oil by rail or pipe, enforce with heavy fines, jail decision makers, demand and oversee reparations, climate and health mitigation. Three, defund and outlaw city or police ownership and or use of tanks, LRAD, or other vehicles within this month, and diesel or gasoline vehicles by January 1st, 2021. Four, promote living green roofs, green eaves, green walls for air cooling and cleaning, fuel, fiber, food, habitat, pollinator, biodiversity as appropriate for structure, beginning with and being required on all new buildings and remodeling existing within City of Portland, all parking lots and garages starting January 1st, 2021, and all city buildings and businesses not paying taxes by January 1st, 2022. Five, promote organic, low water use hemp, bamboo, tule, and native plants traditionally used for fiber for local production for local use of face masks, scrubs, medical aprons, head cover, booties, and medical linens, especially planted and maintained to clean and cool air and water along transportation routes. Six, ban the expansion of PDX and any other airport within city limits. Seven, for local health, safety, climate, regenerative economy, fund, promote, and require local organic food production within walking distance of residents for the entire full nutrition of all city residents.
So Edith, you sound like you feel better. Are you feeling better?
I have huge writing that I have to see and read fast.
Right.
And it comes and goes. Most of the time I have to lie flat with my eyes shut.
Well, it sounds like it's, I hope you're on the mend. The last time I was very worried about you, but I'm glad that you are back and you're here and you're sharing your perspective with us. Thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you, Edith.
Next is Bob Solinger.
Mr. Solinger, welcome.
Good evening, Mayor Weller and members of Portland City Council. Thanks for the opportunity to testify tonight. We appreciate the work that's gone into this resolution, and we appreciate the opportunity to be involved with it. I think it is a really important step forward, and especially I think the integration of racial justice and climate equity, climate change, is a very powerful thing that is the right direction for this city. I want to also express my appreciation for the decision to withdraw support for the I-5 Rose Quarter expansion. This is the project that had glaring deficiencies in it from the day it was conceived. I was on the Northwest Quadrant planning process when it was first brought forward more than a decade ago. And many of the deficiencies that brought it down today were apparent back then. And I think we, at the same time we celebrate what I hope is its demise, I think we also need to consider how it got as far as it did. And we need to apply the kind of lens that we're applying today to projects that are advancing right now. Do they really meet our climate goals? Do they really meet our racial equity goals and our racial justice goals? I think there are many projects that don't right now, and I would put you particularly towards something like the Levee Ready project that has drawn widespread scorn from this community because it doesn't incorporate equity. It doesn't address historic inequities. It doesn't address environmental issues adequately. Yet it is proceeding forward much the same as many of these other mega projects that seem to move under their own momentum until the community finally rises up, but only after we spent tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on them. We need to put these things into effect at the beginning, not the end of these projects. Also want to appreciate the fact that this resolution includes a strong reference to green infrastructure. That's often lost in our climate discussions and in our climate objectives. It's oftentimes sort of the last thing in, but I think we need to begin with our natural systems, how we make them more resilient. That's where a climate strategy should really start. It shouldn't be an afterthought. I worked on the Portland Watershed Management Plan that was passed in 2006. And that plan called for every single city project to incorporate in green infrastructure, to consider how green infrastructure could be part of a project. We're still a long way from there, but if we'd done that back in 2006, we would be a long way toward our climate goals and our equity goals today. So we need to really accelerate that kind of work, and we're glad to see that highlighted in here. I think about things like our tree code that we know is woefully insufficient. River plan is coming at you. We need to take the green roof mandate that's in downtown Portland and expand it citywide. There's a tremendous amount of opportunity, and we miss it every day when it comes to green infrastructure. We also have tremendous opportunities to protect and restore our river, protect our floodplains, and create greater landscape resiliency as well that are directly in front of us. So I think we have a lot of opportunity there. So all in there, really appreciate your work on this, and thank you.
Thank you, Bob. We appreciate your comments.
Next is Derek Boyd.
Welcome, Derek.
Hello. There we go. Hi, my name is Derek Boyd. I live in the Arleta neighborhood. I'm a former Democratic Party of Oregon organizer and volunteer, and I vote in every election. Thanks for giving me some time to speak, and thanks to the other speakers and panelists. I love this city, but the Portland Police Department has worked against the spirit of the community for the entire 22 years I've lived here. They treat progressive activists with disdain and treat people of colors as enemy combatants. And in the time I've lived here, they've killed multiple unarmed people of color and multiple people having mental health emergencies. More recently, PPB has attacked peaceful protesters with disproportionate force.
Eric, this is a climate resolution. Can you speak to the resolution, please?
When I signed up for this meeting, I signed up for, I specifically said I wanted to speak about, so I mean, I can wait until that portion of the meeting. But when I signed up for the meeting, I specifically said I wanted to talk about defunding the police. And that was one of the options it gave me on the agenda.
I wonder if you're on the agenda for tomorrow.
Oh, I signed up for tonight. I thought that this was an option. So is there a way that I could get put on the agenda for tomorrow?
Derek, you're here. It's only 2 minutes. Right. Why don't you go ahead and just finish up? Go ahead and do it.
Okay. So anyway, the actions of the Portland Police Department, so they've not only have they been using disproportionate force against protesters, they've also intentionally been targeting journalists and legal observers, and they've also repeatedly violated the tear gas ban. The actions have been justified as protecting adults in the Justice Center, or adults in custody in the Justice Center, but we're in the middle of a pandemic, and it's been shown that that's like the worst place for people to be, is in jail. So these people are also going in and out, so they also put the rest of the community at risk when they get exposed. Seems like that they would be better served, and we would be better served, if they spent the rest of their time on house arrest, or people that needed a post bail were released on their own recognizance. And let's face it, hardly any of them would be in there if they had a little more money and they could afford bail or a better lawyer. And then they've also, PPB has done barely anything to protect protesters from drivers that have been trying to run them over. Some of these drivers have even taken multiple passes. Someone tried to actually run me and other protesters over on June 2nd. I've tried to file a report, and I can't get a hold of anyone. A detective won't call me back. I've called multiple times, and it's been over a month. The only time that the protests have become violent is when PPB and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office have gotten involved, or when right-wing agitators have instigated violence. I think a big contributing factor of this is that hardly any of the police actually live in Portland. So they treat it like they act like an occupying force. So we need a 100% defunding of PPB, similar to what Camden, New Jersey has done. They've seen a 42% reduction in violent crime, and they've seen a reduction in use of force.
All right,
we need to divert those funds.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Next is Nora Apter.
Before Nora speaks, Commissioner Hardis, do you have your hand raised?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's left over. I'll put it
in. No worry. Okay. Good evening, Nora.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Loud and clear.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in support of the City of Portland's Climate Emergency Declaration. Again, my name is Nora Apter, and I'm the Climate Program Director for the Oregon Environmental Council, or OEC. OEC is a nonprofit organization that advances innovative, collaborative, and equitable solutions to Oregon's environmental challenges for today and future generations. As a native Oregonian, I grew up on the clean air, water, and access to nature that make Oregon the remarkably special place that we all call home. My appreciation for Oregon's natural bounty and beauty, and my commitment to protecting it, inspired me to pursue a career in environmental advocacy. And I remain committed to protecting our home from the gravest environmental threat, climate change, because I recognize the threat that it poses not simply to our way of life, but also and especially to Oregon's vibrant economy, public health, families, and communities. As noted consistently in the testimony we've heard tonight, the science is resoundingly clear that we must act now to prevent irreversible climate harm to our city, state, and planet. In adopting this climate emergency declaration, the City of Portland rightfully recognizes the urgency of the crisis we face. We need to cut pollution significantly and consistently every year in order to reach our climate goals. This is no small task and will require ongoing commitment and leadership. OEC is deeply grateful to the City of Portland for taking this important next step to address climate disruption by focusing on bolder, systemic change for climate justice. We applaud the city for adopting an approach to addressing this crisis that rightfully centers the voices and priorities of those who are most impacted by climate harms, including Portland's Black, Indigenous, and communities of color. As the city has emphatically stated, climate action must be rooted in racial justice, and effectively and equitably addressing climate change demands a racial justice approach. We greatly appreciate the city's commitment to providing a transparent public engagement process and seeking to enable input and engagement from Portlanders representing a broad and diverse demographic. When youth and climate justice leaders expressed concern that the first draft of the declaration did not adequately address climate justice or incorporate community feedback, Mayor Wheeler listened and extended the timeline for public input. We greatly appreciate the city's continued efforts to ensure a robust and inclusive decision-making process now and in the future. In addition to adopting its own climate equity goals, we believe the city also has a critical role to play in supporting other state and local policies and actions to advance climate mitigation. We know that any proposed action to achieve the city and other climate goals will fall flat without science-based, data-driven metrics. The City of Portland is a powerhouse of information, data, and policy analytics that can help inform and advance climate inequity in decision-making. We encourage the city to apply its technical analysis and to provide data and scenario planning for significantly cutting climate pollution to reach climate goals. To conclude, the specific climate justice actions outlined in the Climate Emergency Declaration, if implemented fully and promptly, have the potential to significantly impact the city's greenhouse gas emissions. We would love to see these proposals implemented immediately with a commitment to thoughtful but rapid progress. And we once again sincerely thank the city for its leadership on climate justice.
Thank you, Nora. We appreciate your testimony and your support.
Next is Mindy Smith Reagan.
Welcome.
You appear to be muted.
Can you unmute if you're on this, the phone? It's *6 on your keypad, and if you're on a laptop, if you drag your cursor down to the lower left-hand corner, you should see an unmute. Carla, let's move on to the next person, but we'll come back and see if they can figure that out.
Okay, the next person is Damon Mott-Story.
Welcome.
Good evening, commissioners. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Damon Mott-Story, and I work as the Healthy Climate Program Director for Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Guided by the values and expertise of medical science, we are an organization of over 2,000 health professionals and public health advocates working collaboratively with community partners to educate and advocate for societal and policy change that protects human health at all levels. We would like to extend our deep gratitude for the many hours of work that have gone into this climate emergency declaration, from commissioners' offices to the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to other bureaus to community members. The work that has gone into this is immense, and I think it really shows. The document that we're looking at is an incredible piece of work. And I especially want to note appreciation for the moving slowly to go fast, as Desiree nicely put it, and appreciate the documentation that the city released to show that what comments were received on the draft resolution and what changes were made to respond to the feedback. Climate change is indeed an urgent crisis facing communities worldwide. It is an emergency, and we need to call it what it is. As Hop Hopkins wrote this month in the Sierra magazine, you can't have climate change without sacrifice zones, and you can't have sacrifice zones without disposable people, and you can't have disposable people without racism. So as we face the overlapping epidemics of COVID-19 and violence against Black people, it makes sense to think of climate change as a third ongoing pandemic created by white supremacy and colonialism in the form of polluting industries that must be stopped if my generation and the ones after me are to have a livable future. And I just want to name a couple of things that I particularly appreciate seeing in the Climate Emergency Declaration. One is the acknowledgement of the root cause of climate change is an economy built off of slavery, colonialism, and the unsustainable extraction of natural resources. This is something that one of our team members, Yuvia Morella, pointed out in the fall of 2019 when we implored the city to take a slowdown and incorporate community feedback. And so it's great to see that and some very clear, specific identifications of frontline communities in this resolution. I'm out of time, so I'll just briefly leave you with a couple of questions and I'll submit further comments into the record. But we want to ask the city to consider what could be some unintended consequences of the climate test and the, quote, shadow price on carbon. Want to make sure that there's no unintended bad consequences that could come from that. Want to urge the city to consider making progress reports a little bit more often than once per year. And to push further on advocacy for youth transit passes and eventually fareless transit for all. And then I also finally want to really encourage the city to think deeply about doing an independent third-party study to investigate whether decarbonizing a methane pipeline is possible in regards to Northwest Natural's mention in the Climate Emergency Declaration. So happy to talk more about these things. And again, want to just appreciate everyone who's put in the hard work and effort into getting us to where we are today. And I'm so proud to see this resolution where it is and urge your support of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Damon. And thank you for your hard work as well. We appreciate it. And those are really important questions that you asked.
Next is Leslie Cox.
Hi, Leslie.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. We can hear you, Leslie. Go ahead.
So I'm Leslie Cochin, and this testimony is on behalf of Climate Jobs, the project of Portland Jobs with Justice. First, we want to thank the City of Portland staff, who through many meetings, conversations, and revisions, created a final draft that both acknowledges those who are the most vulnerable to the climate crisis and proposes actions specific to those communities. Climate Jobs recommended the following four additions, all of which are critical to workers, to the city's earlier drafts. One, include workers on the front line of the climate crisis as a frontline community. Two, collaborate with labor unions when city policy and decisions on the climate crisis might be relevant to workers. Three, address the needs of a just transition for workers who will lose jobs as the city moves towards a green economy. And four, address the needs of workers who may, now or in the future, face greater risk due to climate-driven conditions such as hot weather, smoke, and floods. So we're talking about our postal workers, day laborers, construction workers, emergency responders, and others. So we want to thank the city first for speaking to all of these recommendations within this current draft. We were very excited to see that most of our proposed language was included. We did have a question on the fourth recommendation regarding those workers who are at risk or will be at risk, specifically related to health and safety. We had a question about what city is now doing or proposes doing, but that's a discussion we can have later. We also do want to support a more robust decarbonization timeframe. So, and we're pleased to know, as described by Alyssa Kane, that more analysis will be conducted to more quickly move the needle forward here. And we all know how urgent this is. In conclusion, we're pleased with the city's positive response on behalf of those workers in our community who are and who will be on the front line of the climate crisis. And we're excited by the city's response to all of the input provided by the BIPOC communities and youth. We support passage of the declaration, and we urge the city to continue a collaborative process to address remaining concerns. Thank you much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie. We appreciate your testimony.
Next is Loretta Smith.
Welcome, Loretta.
Good evening, Mayor Wheeler.
Hear you loud and clear.
Can you hear me?
Yep, welcome, Loretta.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, Commissioners Hardesty, Udaly, and Frick. My name is Loretta Smith, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of the climate emergency declaration before you this evening. I'm thrilled that the city is committing to climate justice and accelerating its carbon reduction goals. First, I would like to thank the mayor for a second, to thank him for listening to community concerns, slowing down to solicit community input through robust and meaningful public engagement, and crafting a much stronger resolution as a result of those efforts. I believe centering frontline communities and youth in our fight for climate justice is vital to both our short and our long-term success. Considering COVID-19 and racial justice uprisings and the continued economic downturn, our climate action must be intersectional and focus first on protecting frontline communities, predominantly Black and Brown Portlanders. While resolutions with the right language are important, we need to immediately move beyond them to actually change the law and commit funds to climate justice. We code, and we should include climate change as an emergency by law. We need new regulations on major polluters and multi-sector approach towards immediate change, which includes land use, housing, and environmental regulations. And as we continue to reimagine safety, we will have the opportunity to repurpose funds for the just transition we need, one that centers frontline communities, creates good-paying union jobs in the care economy, and makes our communities more resilient to all sorts of crises. I endorsed the Portland Clean Energy Fund in 2018 for the same reasons, and because I believe our solutions to climate change will come from the ground up. As a city commissioner, I will continue to fight for changes in the law and for cash to support community efforts to reduce carbon and become more resilient. As we move forward in the fight for a healthy and sustainable future for generations of Portlanders to come, I really look forward to working with you and community leaders to envision climate change work that makes Portland the global leader of sustainability and climate justice. And I want to thank you for allowing me to have a testimony this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Loretta. We appreciate your testimony. Thanks for being here with us tonight.
Thank you.
Next is Sarah Taylor.
Welcome, Sarah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, there's a weird echo. So if you have more than one device, if you could mute one of them.
Okay.
Try it now.
Okay, just want to make sure.
That's even worse.
Yeah, that's.
Do you have a laptop and a phone? If you have both, mute one of them.
There, is that better?
Yeah, much better. Thanks, Sarah.
Okay, I'm calling from the Lower Willamette River, St. John's and Linton area, and I'm here to support the resolution and to talk about the importance of the comprehensive plan reflecting this climate resolution. Nowhere is the intersection of climate, race, and displacement more evident than in the historic river communities of the Lower Willamette River, Albina, Linton, St. John's, and Giles Lake. in the place of historical occupation, annexation, and displacement, as well as rich natural resources, we now find the fossil fuel hub, the Superfund, and the destruction of thousands of homes, local businesses, and town sites. To meet our climate goals, Portland must acknowledge the racist history of the Giles Lake Industrial Sanctuary and rezone to reflect a commitment to reducing fossil fuels in the Portland Harbor. The comprehensive plan is the blueprint of Portland's beliefs in action. Despite the many resolutions and departments, we have a comprehensive plan map for the Lower Willamette River that fails to address systemic danger, the seismic dangers, the hidden history, fossil fuel resolutions, climate change, and the dramatic destruction of housing in the Lower Willamette. You understand, I trust, the discriminatory nature of delegating the lands and riverfronts of Portland's indigenous, Black, and immigrant neighborhoods as industrial sanctuaries. The land use laws of Oregon never say all the pollution, fossil fuels, and interstate highways must be zoned in one historically displaced community. Right now, you have requested a new economic opportunity analysis. I hope that you require that it include the history of the area and reflects zoning changes that work to reduce carbon emissions, moves to eliminate fossil fuels, repairs and heals the displaced communities, and creates a community-led discussion on what a green working waterfront in Portland could look like. I urge you to engage the youth in the community in creating a comprehensive plan that acknowledges discriminatory displacement, racism, and this climate emergency. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sarah. We appreciate it.
Next is Monica Zazuda.
Hi, Monica.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
My name is Monica Zazueta. Hello again, Mayor Ted Wheeler and council members. On November 20th last year is when we first met. I rewatched the video of that council meeting, and it brought me back to the feelings of fear and confusion of what I had back then. Those feelings amplified with COVID and this year's election. So do you remember, Mr. Wheeler, when you said to me at the end of my testimony, you know we're gonna win this fight, right? I nodded my head and said, yes. I thank you for continuing keeping your word by taking these crucial steps with Portland's climate declaration. I started getting involved with activism because of my son, Aries. He's now six. My passion grew from saving my son to try and save actually everyone else. I came into this very, very young, very head under the rock. And I have been hitting the ground running, just trying to figure out and pull from everywhere of things and ideas of how to make the dream a reality of a greener tomorrow for our kiddos. And it's a lot, and we need more people on it. But according to Green Tech Media, 90% clean grid by 2035 is not just feasible but cheaper. So I do agree with the statements given earlier by Ella, and that we do need to do more. We do. And we can. I mean, there's so many areas that need attention. I mean, our oceans, our homeless, our gas hookups in the houses, affordable college. I mean, we need more people educated so we can fight this. And, having it affordable or no cost. I mean, educating our young ones when they're in preschool. We need more trees, absolutely more trees. Social justice needs to be like, it's so crazy what's going on, and it's sad, and but it's good that it's finally happening, that something's finally going into a direction. We don't know what direction it is, but we're trying to put a shit in the right way, and I know there's good people on that. So really, I would really love Vancouver and Portland to come together, and because I'm from Vancouver, and I would just love Vancouver and Portland to come together and share what works and what doesn't work in the climate action plan, and just
I mean, we're all neighbors. We're all people. We're all human. And I just want us to come together and share our ideas of hope and just have this future that's better than today. There's this one thing I saw on a shirt. It says it was on a young girl. She probably is maybe like 4 or 5 years old and maybe Hispanic descent, skin darker, but on the shirt it read, "Birthplace, Earth, race, human, politics, freedom, religion, love." And I hope you got that. So the birthplace that we're all from is Earth. We all came from the same spot. We're all human. We all believe in freedom, I hope. And I don't know, but we all believe in love. We all believe in love. And I want to bring that message. And
that's 3 minutes.
So thank you so much. And it was great speaking with you again.
Bye. Thanks, Monica. We appreciate your being back. Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next is Diane Meisenhelter.
Hi, Diane. Welcome. Thanks for your patience.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Cool. So I'm going to throw out what I had planned to say tonight and instead just riff off of Desiree and Ella and Peter's wisdom that they shared after listening this evening. Thanks for listening to the community resulting in this vastly improved document and a potentially groundbreaking process. I loved that Desiree speaks of collaborative governance. I think this is what we need to move forward with BIPOC and youth leadership and other community organizations, not only just for the climate crisis, but also reimagining public safety or all of the kinds of systemic changes we need for the current lethal threats we face, whether it's climate chaos, COVID-19, the police violence and violence and racial inequity, or the economic inequality and the devastation that we're currently going to be facing in that realm. So I'm very excited about the potential for this. And I want to just say that I really hope that you will seriously take the amendments proposed by the Portland Youth Climate Council into account tonight. They're so important. The net zero 2035 is very critical because, as you said, Mayor, this next decade is what the IPCC and scientists say is absolutely critical if we're going to prevent unthinkable devastation, both in terms of species, planet, and human lives. And so we need to act quickly. And the IPCC report, and then secondly, their second recommendation of the 8% annual steps towards decarbonization each year is critical. The IPCC report right before the COP25 in Madrid this year said that global carbon emissions need to drop at least 8% annually to avoid catastrophic climate change. And since the U.S. is the second largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world and the highest emitter per capita, our action that is required is far higher than just that 8%. And in the spirit of this declaration, this is an issue of racial justice between the global South and the global North. And it's also an issue of racial justice here, because if we can't set the stage in terms of what needs to happen, these global goals will not be met unless communities all around the world start to take this seriously and start to implement these goals step by step with concrete plans so that change is possible. We know that without concrete plans and concrete steps for the changes will not be coming. And we've seen that already. So please tonight just support their amendment and make this happen. There's a lot of hope here.
Thank you, Diane. Appreciate your testimony tonight.
Next is Lauren Ulmer.
And Carla, how many do we have after Lauren?
Just one more.
Ah, very good. Excellent. Good afternoon, Lauren. evening, whatever time it is.
Looks like you're still muted, Lauren.
Lauren, are you there? If you're on a laptop, if you can move your cursor to the lower left-hand corner. If you're on the phone, try *6 on your keypad, see if that works. Let's see, there, Lauren, did it work or did we lose her? I think she disconnected. If she calls back, Carla, we'll go ahead and take her.
Certainly.
Who's next?
We'll go with Sandy Polishek.
Hey, Sandy, how are you tonight?
Fine, thank you. And you?
Good, excellent. Thank you for asking. It's good to hear your voice.
Well, I appreciate it, Mayor and Council, that we have this opportunity. I'm not going to offer any suggestions for improvement. I really am wanting to celebrate this. The last of many, of numerous initiatives that we at 350 PDX have worked with you on, and have been grateful that you, the climate crisis has been taken seriously by the city. I certainly did not, it's 7 years last month since I was sat around a kitchen table with six people at the founding, the 1 month after the founding of 350 PDX. And I did not dream that we would be where we are today. And I'm very grateful and happy and celebrate this, all the work that's gone on to this and how far the city has come. And of course, we still have plenty more to do. But I also want to say that today is my first and only great-grandchild's 10th month birthday. And it is, of course, for all the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren that we do this work. I'm far too old to see the worst of what will come if we don't do it. And I care a lot. I care about the future. I care about my family, your family, and all the children of everyone in the world, and especially to all of you who are listening. So I just want to thank you, City Council, and I want to encourage you to continue to move forward on climate justice. Thanks for realizing and acknowledging that it is an emergency. And thanks for this hearing.
Sandy, thank you for your testimony. And I want to thank you for your years of advocacy and your pushing and your guidance. And I remember meeting with you many, many years ago when I was state treasurer and listening to your thoughts and your ideas. And I couldn't be happier to see this intersect between our work here tonight. And thank you. Thank you for all you've done. And thank you for your patience tonight. Carla, did we find Lauren? Did she call back?
Mayor, I'm not seeing her back on the list, so I do not believe so.
I don't think so either. Lauren, you're not out there somewhere, are you? All right. Is there anybody else?
That's the end of the list that I have.
Okay, very good. With that then, colleagues, do you have any more questions before we call the roll on the resolution? Actually, we'll start with the amendments, but then we'll go into the line. Commissioner Hardesty.
No, I'm fine with doing the amendments one at a time, please.
All right, very good. With that then, we'll start with Commissioner Udaly's amendment regarding the congestion pricing agreements. Any further discussion?
I have a question, Commissioner Udaly. We started talking about congestion pricing probably a year and a half ago, And then we haven't talked about it at all since then. And I'm not comfortable that the state would actually develop an equitable carbon pricing plan that would actually center frontline communities. That has not been my experience. So I'm concerned that we're putting an amendment in that basically gives the state permission to do something that we have not had deeper conversations on.
I certainly can appreciate your concern, Commissioner. As I think you know, I've set up a pricing options for equitable mobility task force. To look at all the options and for congestion pricing, as well as possibilities for how that revenue is spent. I'm wondering if Chris can pipe in about possibly strengthening the language. We would have influence here.
I would just say
if it doesn't meet our
listening to us so far. So just to say to them, do something that's equitable doesn't sound like that's kind of the right direction for us.
Right. And after my experience with the steering committee, I can't argue with that. But the intent of the amendment is that they would have to satisfy our requirements. So I
support that goal. I just don't think that's the language that gets us to the goal that you're trying to achieve.
So is Chris still here?
I am, yeah.
Because maybe we can kind of amend the amendment.
Yeah. If we're going to probably revisit it, it would probably be good to have a discussion and probably not try to do it on the fly. But certainly our pricing options for equitable mobility is really, we look at that as kind of the gold standard in terms of setting up the kind of the community conversation. In fact, ODOT has looked at something similar in terms of they're having discussions about how they would price it. So, we look for our leadership to lead on this, but we'll certainly, as we're moving along, be willing to take a look at that language to make sure that it works for us, because we do think that the framework that we're setting up, I think, is where we intend to go, and I think we could really be the leaders in terms of making sure that equitable mobility is really part of any kind of pricing regime.
Yeah. And so what's your desire for this evening?
Okay.
I would like to advance the amendment. It's an important kind of line in the sand that we want to draw. The language we included in the comp plan apparently wasn't strong enough for ODOT to take us seriously about congestion pricing.
And part of it is, I think we're really not telling them to do it. We're saying we won't support the project unless it does it and it meets our values. I think that's what the intent is. And I think that's where, that's the direction that that we would intend to support.
So my fear is that as a council, we have not had a conversation about whether we would support congestion pricing. And I've heard nothing yet that would lead me to believe I would support that as a method for reducing traffic. So I just think that it's just putting the council in a spot that we haven't had the detailed conversation yet. We were hoping that your task force would come back with recommendations. And so I just think that it's premature to... I think we don't have anything that we are weighing against an equitable system, right? Because what the state may think is equitable, we won't consider equitable.
So, it's a proven strategy, and it's really one of the only strategies to manage demand.
But in some cases and in some locations, but I haven't seen enough information here locally to believe that would be our only alternative to expanding freeways.
Commissioner Fritz has her hands up.
Thank you. Could you read the language in your amendment again, please, Commissioner Daly?
Sure. And just to be clear,
we're not recommending.
We're saying that we won't support their projects without it. We can't dictate how they do it, but we can certainly lead in this conversation, and we can reject any efforts that don't meet our requirements. So the language is: be it resolved that since freeway expansions disproportionately harm communities of color and increase carbon emissions, the City of Portland will require demand management, including congestion pricing, implemented equitably and in close collaboration with BIPOC communities before any future freeway construction or expansion project.
And I don't recall what we have in the comprehensive plan regarding congestion pricing. Does anybody happen to know that?
It was language that only pertained to Rose Quarter I-5.
In the comprehensive plan?
I believe so. It was Commissioner Saltzman brought that forward, and I believe it was kind of a gesture to move the conversation along at the time.
I concur with Commissioner Hardesty's concern that we haven't had the discussion yet. I'm wondering, could we reframe the amendment to say that they would consider to ask them to consider it, which would then leave you, the council at the time, the option of weighing in on whether or not to do it, or
That makes that really weakens the amendment to the point that it's pointless. I mean, they're free to consider it or not.
I wondered if we could propose something that just basically said that that you will not seek our agreement in any expansion project unless we have worked directly with frontline communities to identify whatever, right? I mean, I'm just concerned about using congestion pricing will make somebody think that we've had a conversation and we all agree that congestion pricing is the only fix to our system.
Well, to be clear, it says demand management, including congestion pricing. It's not exclusively congestion pricing, because there are a range of ways to manage demand. I personally think that congestion pricing is our best bet for freeways, but this amendment is not requiring.
For the sake of tonight, would you accept a friendly amendment that scratched out the words congestion pricing and left everything else?
So before Commissioner Daly answers that, so the transportation system plan, which this speaks to, is part of the comprehensive plan. Chris, could you speak to that, please?
Yeah, I think the language that the commissioner was talking about was part of the Central City Plan, which is part of the comp plan. I think what we said there is a pricing before the completion of the project is a language that we had used in the comp plan that was adopted.
Should I read the comp plan policy for you? It's policy 9.50, regional congestion management. Coordinate with Metro to establish new regional multimodal mobility standards that prioritize transit, freight, and system completeness. And then 9.50A, create a regional congestion management approach, including a market-based system to price or charge for auto trips and parking, better accounts for the cost of auto trips, and to more efficiently manage the regional system. So we do have that in the comprehensive plan. So although we have this council hasn't discussed it, it is established as a policy in the comprehensive plan.
But somehow that language wasn't strong enough to compel ODOT or to convince them that they needed to do that. Commissioner Hardesty, I'm I will accept your amendment if we can't move forward with my amendment tonight. It's ambitious and exciting to me that we would take the stance. I don't know that any other city in the U.S. has. And I just want to be clear that there are a variety of methods for demand management. And that the reason I established that task force is that I am bound and determined that anything we do not further burden or disparately impact BIPOC communities, low-income workers, small business owners, people with disabilities. So, you know, we're very committed to that. And
as am I. I just was very concerned because the last time we talked about congestion pricing, you were going to a conference and you came back not really sold on the idea. And we haven't actually talked about it in some detail in a while. So,
right. I mean, the conversation predates your arrival at council, and it wasn't that I wasn't sold on congestion pricing. It's that I realized when this was looking at surface streets in the city, the conversation about ODOT is strictly freeways. So I came back and realized we have a lot of work to do. We need to have a much better public transit system before we implement anything like you see in London or Stockholm. But the conversation about freeways is a separate conversation for me. I don't see, you know, any other way to fund some of the things that we're hoping to fund and to manage the demand. But like I said, if that's what you're comfortable with, it's still a step in the right direction and we can have those further conversations. Some of the possible uses of revenue I just want to mention real quick is to, and it depends on where this is happening and what agency is kind of owns it, but that revenue could fund alternatives such as improved and expanded public transit, bike and pedestrian infrastructure. We could use revenue to invest, or they could use revenue to invest in restorative justice efforts. I would still like to see the caps on I-5. I would love to see ODOT just come back and do something, offer a remedy for the harm that was done 60 years ago, whether there's a freeway project involved or not. We can provide free or discounted alternatives such as transit and offer subsidies, discounts, caps, and exemptions for low-income drivers, people with disabilities, small businesses. So I just wanted to give you a sense of what the direction we're thinking.
I'm happy to support it with that minor amendment.
Okay, thank you.
So to be clear, just so I don't come a cropper of our legal counsel, does that require an amendment to the amendment?
I think so.
Okay, let's do that. Commissioner Udaly has offered an amendment. Commissioner Hardesty, I take it, has seconded it.
That's correct.
Head nod on that. Call the roll on the amendment to the amendment. We'll put it on the table.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. So that amendment is now on the table, and we'll just call it the Udaly amendment for simplicity's sake, because it's late and I'm starving. Aren't you guys hungry? I'm starving. Next up, are there any other questions about the Udaly amendment before I call the roll on the Udaly amendment? All right, Carla, call the roll on the Udaly amendment.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Well, thanks for the conversation, everyone. It's not quite as far as I had hoped for, but this is still a step in the right direction, and I appreciate your support. Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Wheeler.
I agree with Commissioner Daly that we should be aggressive. We should push hard. There's nothing about this amendment or the resolution that does not allow us to continue to do that. This was a conversation we had when Commissioner Saltzman was here. It was a good conversation then. It's a good conversation now. I vote aye. The amendment is adopted. The second amendment on the table is the Fritz Amendment related to transit passes. Is there any further discussion or questions related to that? Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. Commissioner Fritz, I do have a question about that amendment. My understanding is that the $1 billion transportation package has some dollars in it to pay for transit passes. I'm wondering why we keep thinking we need to pay for transit passes rather than TriMet needs to reduce its budget and not be so reliant on students paying a fee. I'm concerned that we'll keep developing mechanisms to keep TriMet ongoing, and I continue to wonder why TriMet even exists. And so this amendment doesn't force us to actually go out and buy money and find money to subsidize TriMet, which in my mind gets a lot of money from a lot of small businesses. I know I paid into it quite a bit and never gotten anything out of TriMet. So I'm really concerned that we're developing these mechanisms to feed a beast that my question is, why does it even exist?
Gosh, as somebody who depends on TriMet to get to work every day in the going to work days, I can't imagine living in the city without transit, without public transit.
I misunderstood my point. My point is not whether or not we should have public transit. My point is that we have a bureaucracy that's running our regional transportation system, and our efforts are all about reinforcing the bureaucracy rather than asking the question, why does the governor appoint TriMet? Why do we continue to pay for services that we don't get? And so I'm just concerned that we're acting as if TriMet is operating appropriately and effectively, and I don't share that perspective.
I don't either. And the one volunteer thing I might want to do after I finish my service on the county is on the commission is to see if I can get on the TriMet board while the governor's still appointing it. I do agree that it needs to be more equitable and probably directly elected. And it certainly needs to have more people on it to actually ride the buses and trains. This language that I've proposed is actually in the adopted comprehensive plan, and it is intended to get, hopefully, to eventually to universal fare free. You're right, Commissioner. The Metro measure for November includes $9 million a year ongoing for universal year-round free transit for everybody under 18.
Actually, no, that's not true. It's a graduated approach. It actually starts with high schools first, and at some point, elementary school kids will become beneficiaries, but it's not universal. And it's just for high school kids.
It doesn't cover middle school right now.
Not going to cover middle school.
Huh.
And sometime in the future, it will cover middle school, so it's not universal at all.
All right, well, so we gave Commissioner Fritz her platform. There it is for her.
Already looking for a new job.
I guess it's fine if it's just making the language consistent, but I just want to just state for the record that I think that we're having the wrong conversation about TriMet, and at some point we really need to have a conversation about why does it exist in its current formation, and why do we keep feeding the...
And if you check in the comprehensive plan, there's a lot of talk about equitable transportation and including the values that you and I both share, Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. Okay, I will take back my objection because it's late and we're all hungry and we got a vote still on the.
We did because if we don't, I'm going to keep eating all these bars. Weigh like 400 pounds by the time I'm done with this meeting. All right.
Why didn't you people eat at 6 o'clock? What were you doing at 6?
Phone calls, Zoom calls.
Yeah, meetings. The meeting, the call. Right.
So we got a lot of city staffers just on edge here. So any further discussion on Commissioner Fritz's amendment before we call the roll? Seeing none, Carla, please call the roll.
Courtesy.
Yes, I will support this amendment, but I'm hoping that at some point in the near future we have the broader conversation. I vote aye.
You, Daly.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Fritz. I was just reflecting on the fact that
roads are the only utility that we don't charge based on usage, I like the idea of, and I don't necessarily agree with that, but I do like the idea of free public transit. So happy to vote aye.
Fritz.
If we're going to move the dial on climate disruption, we need to get people out of their cars. And so this is the way that, you know, in Corvallis, when they did it, 37% increase in ridership. Mm-hmm. And Kansas City is doing it. Olympia already, Washington already does it. Cities across the world are looking to do something like this. So I want us to be bold and to look at it as a climate emergency issue, regardless of the governance of TriMet, Commissioner Hardesty. The bottom line is we need to get people out of their cars. Aye.
Wheeler.
I strongly support this, and I support what you just said, Commissioner Fritz. I vote aye. The amendment is adopted. Now to the substitute resolution as amended. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty?
Wow, it took us almost a year to get to this spot, didn't it? I want to be very thankful and appreciative of both the city council slowing down and engaging the community in a much deeper level. I want to really appreciate the incredible work of Andrea Durbin and her fine team, who have just kept a very positive attitude through all the stops and starts that we've had through this process. I think that we're moving in the right direction, and I support the young people who say we have to be bolder and faster, but I know we will have additional information within the next 6 months or so that will help inform how we move forward. So I look forward to us being bolder and braver, but I think that we're off to a great start with a lot of community support, and I'm happy to vote aye.
You daily.
Well, I just have a long list of thank yous. First, all of the community groups and advocates that coalesced around this effort and really pushed us to dig deeper and go further. There's too many for me to mention, but I do want to call out a few that my office has worked with directly. And that includes Sunrise PDX, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Unite Oregon, as well as many of the groups that were represented and invited testimony today. And thank you to every single person and organization, whether you've written letters or come to council to testify, and particularly BIPOC and youth-led organizations who really should be at the front of this movement. I am often frustrated by the systems within which we have to function and the mind-numbing level of bureaucratic processes, but today I'm reminded that bureaucracy is made up of a lot of really incredible people and that we can do amazing things together. So I want to thank Director Durbin and everyone at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, including Elisa Kane and Michelle Krim, for leading this work. Director Warner and my amazing PBOT staff, thank you. Mayor Wheeler and Mayor's team, particularly Amanda Watson, thank you. Director Long and the Parks Department, Chief Administrative Officer Tom Reinhart, I don't thank you often enough, so thank you, Tom. And his team at OMF, and finally, my policy director, Jamie Duhamel. I'm really proud of this joint effort, and I vote aye.
Fritz.
It's good to see each council, each mayor leading an initiative on this and prioritizing it. I think it might be one of the themes through the three mayors that I've served with that grabbed your attention and demanded your attention and action. So thank you for that. Thank you for taking the time to spend the extra engagement with the community. Thanks to all the youth and all the climate action advocates. We set realistic goals that it's going to be challenging to achieve, and we can do better. So these are a floor, not a ceiling. And if we can get there faster, then I think we all know that we need to. So thank you for that. In terms of the amount of time that this declaration has taken, I did appreciate Desiree Williams-Raji pointing out that it's stronger for that. And also the leadership of Don Sampson from the Native community. It's significant that he gave it as our blessing that he spoke to us from the Umatilla Reservation and took the time to be with us tonight. And he certainly is a revered leader in the Indigenous community, and I thank him very much. Thanks to Ella Schreiner and Peter Salinger. You know, sometimes people come in on one issue and they come and they go, and that's the last you see of them until maybe they come back 10 years later and say, well, I did this one thing. And these two individuals in particular have been leaders for their community of youth. And I appreciate that they worked with my office on oil trains and coal trains and a number of other things. And again, we're going to do more. That those are baselines. I also want to thank, Jerry Williams Jimenez, who is an enrolled member of the Klamath Tribes, who for many years was with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement and the Diverse Civic Leadership Program. She was talking about environmental justice long before a lot of other people were, and really pointing out the impacts to communities of color from I-5 and the various things that white people have done over the years. And so I thanks to Jerry. I'm particularly pleased not only with the transit items in the action plan, but also the action plan on the action item on trees and requiring the Bureau of Planning to move forward with greater protection for trees. And we need to continue to plant trees. So lots of the other strategies are merely not making it any worse. Protecting trees and natural areas are the one thing we can do that actually will make it better. And so I do... I want you as ongoing council members to make sure that you are acting to protect trees and plant more of them, and also to protect our natural areas. We have been allowing a significant amount of people living in natural areas during the COVID pandemic, and a lot of damage is being caused. And so we need to recognize that there are different kinds of crises that we are facing right now, and that we need to weigh and balance all of the different things and make sure that we look to the long term while we're also looking after people in the short term. So thank you very much. I'm happy to vote aye.
Wheeler.
Well, I want to thank everybody who presented today, and I certainly want to thank everybody who testified today. This was a great conversation. This resolution, of course, would not be possible without the input and feedback from all of the community leaders, the advocates, the residents who called on Portland to declare a climate emergency and provided what I thought was really valuable input and feedback to help us shape this declaration. So thanks to all of you. I also want to just thank Chair Kafoury again for being here earlier today and for the Multnomah County's partnership with the city on climate planning over the years and on the development of a new climate justice initiative together with frontline communities. Thank you to my council colleagues and their staff and the bureau directors and the staff who reviewed and improved the declaration's language. And in particular, thanks to Elisa Kane and Michelle Krim at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability for all of your incredible work on the resolution over the past year. The Climate Emergency Declaration is an important starting block for this new chapter in Portland's climate action, but the work continues from here. I look forward to hearing regular updates on the progress towards our emissions reduction goals and the development of the Climate Justice Initiative. I want to thank the members of my staff who worked so hard on this, Amanda Watson, in particular, Sam Diaz, and others who really worked hard over the course of the last year to bring this fruition. Thanks to you. Thanks to everyone. I am very pleased to vote aye. The substitute resolution as amended is adopted. Thank you all, and we are adjourned.